Might as well.
This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Glenn Bremenkamp. Today is 17 August 2009. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Bremenkamp is joining me from his home in Biloxi, Mississippi. I'm interviewing Mr. Bremenkamp today in order to gain his reminiscences of his experiences as a forward air controller with both the 22nd Tactical Air Support Squadron and the 23rd Tactical Air Support Squadron in South Vietnam. Mr. Bremenkamp, to start this interview off, I'd like to get a little biographical information, if I could. Could you tell me when you were born and where?
I was born March 25th, 1933, near Colby, Kansas.
Out west, then, out west in the plains. What were your parents' names?
I'm George Bremenkamp and Anna Bremenkamp.
What did your folks do for a living out there?
My dad was a quasi-farmer. I think he bought and sold land more than he farmed, but we did farm.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of things were you farming?
Dry land wheat farm. Mm-hmm. First.
Mm-hmm. Did your mother work outside the farm, or did she stay?
No, she was just a home wife.
Right, right. What about brothers and sisters? Did you have any siblings?
I still had two living brothers and one living sister.
Mm-hmm. What was it like growing up outside near Colby, Kansas, there in the 1930s and 1940s?
Well, I do remember growing up. I remember one dust storm. That's all out of all of them. I probably wasn't old enough. And my first year of school, I went to a country school, one-room schoolhouse. There were two of us in the first grade and a seventh grader and an eighth grader.
Wow.
And that was the whole school student body.
Wow.
And then I think my dad sold that farm and we moved into the city, and he had a farm that was outside of town. He had a farm that was outside of the town. And from then on, I attended a grammar school in Colby, Kansas.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that you were born in 1933, correct?
That's right.
So World War II, I would think, would have had quite an impression on a young man in middle America such as yourself, or a young child such as yourself. What do you remember about the war?
What do I remember? Mainly I remember the B-24s flying over at low level. I guess they were flying their missions out of airfields that were close around out there in western Kansas. I had an uncle who spent the whole war at Guadalcanal. And came back with malaria, which he fought for many years. Don't remember much about it. I do remember the, scrap drives, rationing of tires, gasoline, different foodstuffs. I remember the little ration tokens and stamps, things like that. And how my dad used to use gasoline for the farm in his vehicles. Or in the car we had.
Mm-hmm. What about, or maybe I should ask this, how closely were you following the war? By the time the war ended, you would have been, let's see, you were born in March, so you would have been, 12 years old in 1945?
I don't know if really followed it that close or not. I do know that, all we had was, mainly word of mouth and radio, and I don't know, I guess paid attention to some, to some of the bigger battles and things like that, but really wasn't that. I did have a cousin also who went, so I guess we were pretty well connected to the war.
Right. You said some of the major battles you might pay attention to. Do you remember any of the ones in particular?
Well, I remember Iwo Jima and the Battle of the Bulge. I remember when that came on, and it was, pretty much a high topic. That's about it.
Okay, now, when did you graduate from high school there in Colby?
I graduated in 51.
Okay, so you graduated high school in 1951, and this was at Colby as well, right?
No, I was in Norton, Kansas.
We moved
all over northwest Kansas because my dad bought and sold farms all the time, it seemed like. He dealt in land a lot. We'd farm a couple of years, and he'd find a deal, somebody make him a deal, and he'd buy another farm. So we moved quite a bit.
Okay, so you went to high school then at Norton, Kansas.
Well, my freshman year, I went to a little town called Almena, Kansas, which was 11 miles from Norton. And then we moved to, bought a farm outside of Norton, and I went to Norton High School, which are all up in, which all of them are in Northwest Kansas.
Yes, sir.
Of course.
Well, you moved around quite a bit. What was this like as a child growing up? What was it like to move around these little towns?
Didn't make any difference. It was, you know, just interesting to country kid and just, you know, find something new. And big deal was, see, we were out on the farm, and that was it. You know, that, I guess just moving around came with the territory.
I guess so, especially considering your father's occupation, I guess.
Right.
Well, what sort of things did you like to do in high school in terms of activities, sports,
academics?
See,
I tried to play basketball, and I played football up until my start of my junior year, and I decided I'd had enough injuries and been banged up enough, and I dropped that and continued with basketball, and played basketball from my sophomore, junior, and senior year. We went state tournaments my sophomore year and my junior year, and then my senior year we won our Class A state tournament, which was a pretty good thrill. I think we were 26-1.
That is a very big thrill for a little country town out in western Kansas,
imagine. We were, you know, in our category, we were all, you know, same size schools just about.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't win another until 2001. So.
That's quite a drought.
They had a drought.
Well, what about academics there in high school? What sort of subjects did you like? What did you gravitate toward?
Well, I guess I went for history more than anything else. I had a heck of a time with second year algebra. I remember that. But once I got through that, well, all the other maths were okay, and that was mainly it. I was on the yearbook staff, took a physics class, and I guess I took some more math. But after that second year algebra, I thought I was finished that second year algebra. I didn't have a good basic freshman year in algebra, so.
I think a lot of people can certainly relate to that.
It messed me up.
Well, growing up in the late 1940s and early 1950s, how aware were you, would you say, of larger global trends, things such as the Cold War and U.S. foreign policy and things like that?
Didn't pay that much attention to it at all, really. I was just more interested in our own little old world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot recall, you know, any back that far back, but I can't recall, you know, being too concerned. No, we knew there was an atomic bomb out there, but we hadn't reached that point yet of put your head between your knees, you know, and all that, and crouching down in the classroom. That hadn't started yet. So.
Okay. Well, what about as a 17 and an 18 year old young man? What
well,
about the
my,
Korean
at,
War?
At 18, my plan was to go to college, so I did. I came from a fair, my family was not too well off, so I was going to work for a year and at a Coca-Cola plant, and I was going to work for a year and save up enough to do my freshman year in one of the Kansas universities. And when I reached, I guess it's 19, that Korean War was going on, and the lady on the draft board said, "I think you're going to be called your number next month or two." She said, "If you don't want to be drafted, start thinking of other things." So my buddy and I went down to the Air Force recruiter and listened to his tale, and both of us enlisted in the Air Force.
Okay, so with the specter of the Korean War.
I didn't want to be an infantryman.
Sure, sure. So it is definitely, the war itself has definitely influenced your decisions on what you're going to do. You have probably an early word that you will likely get drafted soon, and that working the Coca-Cola bottling plant isn't going to save you from the draft. It doesn't sound like
that one.
And that maybe college is going to have to be put off. So you chose the Air Force. Now, can you tell me why you chose the Air Force?
Because that recruiter gave us a song and dance about how we could get a commission in 6 months or a year. and how simple it was to do this, and both of us bought into it. Well, after getting into basic training, the first thing they did is put us both, 80 of us started out. I don't know, was not just the flight I was in of, you know, recruits or whatever, but my buddy was one of them, and he immediately failed the eye exam. Well, I went through, got through the physical part of it. Then we had to take all these tests and everything, and out of the 82 of us, there were only two of us that were standing at the end.
That's incredible. Everybody else washed out.
Everybody else washed out before they even got to go to cadets.
Oh, wow. Right, so you and one other were the only ones to
make
it through.
Only ones that went, and I chose going to NAV school to become a backseat flyer in a F-94Cs.
Now, why did you choose NAV school?
Well, because it was only 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't work out that way. And my other guy, the other guy went to pilot training. I don't know what happened to him. I should have gone to pilot training, but that's, you know, that was water under the bridge. And got through my basic training and sat around as a casual until, oh, 2 or 3 months, I guess, and they sent me to Waco, Texas and said, well, you're going to have to do something. So I became a flight line mechanic. And they pretty soon they said, well, we've backlogged so much in this program, many of you might as well just start pick another program to go to. So most of us chose to go to Bomb Nav School at Ellington Air Force Base down in Houston, Texas. So that was where I ended up. I think around November, because I enlisted in May, so that was about then is when I started my cadet training and NAV training.
Okay, now let me back up a little bit. You've made it through the physical parts, the physical examination. You've made it through some of the early rounds, the early batteries of tests.
Right.
As you said, many others obviously didn't make it, and that you've chosen NAV school. Now, before we get there, where did you go through a basic training? Did you go through?
I went through a place called Parks Air Force Base out in California.
Okay.
Out in the San Joaquin Valley is all I remember.
Well, tell me about this basic training for you out there.
All I remember, it was hot during the day and cold at night.
Do you remember anything about your routine?
The routine, I think the only routine I remember is marching up and down the gun streets and pulling KP duty and being harassed by the drill instructor. But that's about all I remember about it. I don't even remember the classroom parts of it at all, but I know they probably put us through the classroom. I know I'd been a hunter all my life and went out on that target range hoping I'd be an expert rifleman, and all I got was marksman. Couldn't shoot that carbine straight to save myself.
What type of a weapons were they training you on?
Some kind of carbine, M1 carbine or something like that. It wasn't a rifle. It was a carbine. It was not as big as a rifle.
Mm-hmm. So not too many experiences have stuck with you about basic training out there in California.
No, not really. Just remember the temperature fluctuations from day and night. The fact that I sat there I finished basic, let's see, May, June, probably the end of June, I sat there July and August and went to Waco, and it was 120 degrees in Waco. I do remember that.
That will definitely get your attention. Now, explain to me again, what were you going to do? You finished basic, and you go to Waco. What are you going to do at Waco again?
I was going to go through radar. You were called a radar operator in the backseat of an F-94 interceptor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a six-month course, and that was the, one of the early, I guess, one of the first radar-equipped fighter interceptors that the Air Force had. I'm not too sure. All I know, it was a six-month course, and you got your commission and your wings and headed for Korea.
So you knew that was going to be your ultimate goal or your ultimate destination, not necessarily.
Right.
Okay. Well, tell me about this there. Tell me about the training that you underwent there in Waco.
Well, I didn't do any training at Waco at all.
Okay.
All I did on Waco was work on the flight line, work on airplanes.
Okay.
I did sheet metal riveting and a little bit of welding training and just general maintenance on airplanes. And I learned how to put safety wire on bolts and stuff, nuts and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And from there, where did you go from this time in Waco?
Went from there. When they told us, there's too many guys in the backlog, going to be forever getting through the radar school. They told us to pick another course or pick another program. And all of us knew the only other program was either go to Ellington Air Force Base in Houston or Harmsen Air Force Base down in Brownsville, Texas is where it was. I'm not too sure where Arlington is, or was, probably not a base anymore.
Mm-hmm. So you chose Houston.
So I chose to go to Houston, go to NAV school in Houston.
Okay. Now tell me about NAV school. What was it like back then?
Well, mainly it was just getting through cadets, just doing all kinds of visual navigation, celestial navigation, weather. We built I remember two of us together built a radio, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Was there any particular area of navigation that you were specializing in while you were there?
Well, no, because it was just a basic course.
Okay.
And then from there you graduated, and according to your ranking, you could pick a course like going to be a bomb nav on the B-36 or you go to MAT, at that time, the Military Air Transport Service, on cargo aircraft as a navigator. I'm trying to think of what other. I know what I ended up picking was to go to A-26 bomb nav, which was, I don't know how long the course was, but I remember it just sounded like a good deal, so decided that's what I wanted to do.
So did you do pretty well here in Houston at NAV school, basic NAV school?
I got through it, let's put it that way.
you got through it. Okay, so A-26 is now, this was your first choice then?
It was B-26.
Oh, I'm sorry, B-26, yes.
One of my first, at that time, it was B-26s. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I went to B-26 school. That school was out in Sacramento, Mather Air Force Base, Sacramento. Mm-hmm. So I bundled up and go to Mather. In the meantime, just before I left, I met my future wife and had a couple of dates, maybe dated each other for about 2 or 3 months, something like that.
Did you meet her in Houston?
Met her in Houston. Her blind date canceled out, so I ended up her blind date.
Well, it sounded like it worked out pretty well in the long run.
In the long run, it did.
So I don't mean to apply in the short run, it didn't.
Ended up going out there to Mather we trained in B-25s, and there were, I think there were three of us trained at a time in flight, when we flew in the B-25, and you had to, got to drop bombs at the old Norden bomb site. I remember that.
Well, tell me about that. Obviously, this is kind of a holdover from the Second World
War.
Second
World War, that old Norden bomb site, and the B-25 was noisy as all get out, and we flew one guy, only room up in front in the nose, to navigate, and all he did was visual navigation. He had no navigation aids and outside of a compass, and all you did was navigate by dead reckoning and visual navigation of getting a fix off of the ground, whatever you recognize on the ground. And in order to get up in front and back, you had to go past the pilots, crawl over the bomb bay, and get back in the back of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the back was, of course, you flew probably 2.5-3 hour missions, and of course you always took a lunch or something like that. I remember the nastiest thing we did was drop Coke bottles out after we finished them. That was mean. I don't know what possessed us to do stuff like that.
Well, take me through some of these practice runs and your training. How is it that you become proficient using the Norden site and become
you actually had bombs. You had what they call blue whistlers. They weighed, I guess, 100 pounds, and they were painted blue. They were inerts, and we'd go to a target which had just rings around it, circular, and you had to have I think it was below 150 foot circular error in order to graduate. I do remember, even though I had to salvo one time all the bombs because one of them wouldn't release at a time, I still ended up with 25-foot circular error. So I was eligible to graduate.
Yeah, it's a terrific number.
But didn't graduate.
Why wouldn't you graduate it?
Well, just remember the Korean conflict was on, and 1 week before our class was to receive our wings and graduate, they signed an armistice, or whatever, truce, whatever you want to call it. And immediately they canceled our program. I mean, right there on the, as soon as that was signed, I mean, they 1 week to go, oh, you can talk about guys that were upset. I'm, of course, me one of them. But they canceled our program just that quick because they didn't need any more in the pipeline to go over there and get shot at, I guess. And so they said, pick another school.
So you never did finish the
school? So I never did finish that, B-26 bomb nav school.
I'll be darned. Now, how long were you at this? How long did this training last?
I think it was only a little over 8 weeks, 8 weeks or 10 weeks, something like that. So all I did is I sat back and said, what's the longest course I can choose?
Why did you want the longest one?
I don't know. I just, at that time, I was fed up, I guess. I don't know. I wanted to stay, I wanted to go to stay in class, I guess. So I ended up picking Basic Observer Aircraft Performance Engineer.
Now,
at that time, the B-36 had two flight engineers on it, and one of them was commissioned, and the other one was enlisted. And also, they had assignments to transport aircraft, but you didn't. They were putting us through a course in order to become engineers and replace the enlisted engineers on the B-36. At that time, the B-36 still, you know, was the big B-52 was just coming in, you know, at that time, and they still had a big fleet of B-36s. And so I said, okay. And in the meantime, I called it, phoned back and forth this lady in Houston, and we ended up getting married in January of 1954.
Is that right?
And I graduated from the Basic Aircraft Performance School in June, I believe it was, of 54.
Okay, about 6 months later then.
About 6 months later.
Now, you mentioned that they were in the process of replacing the enlisted with officers.
Right.
What was the mindset there? Why were they doing that?
Typical of leadership, you know, we need, this is a, since you got one of the flight engineers is in, commissioned, we need to commission the other flight engineer has to have a commission. It's typical Air Force thinking about officer versus enlisted in certain positions. It's like, you know, enlisted can't fly, or supposedly can't fly airplanes. Well, they can fly an airplane just as well.
Right.
But only the Navy did that.
Now, you mentioned, just kind of in passing, that it was a typical Air Force attitude or a typical Air Force approach. What do you mean by that? Can you explain that?
Well, I can't explain it except that there are just certain positions that the Air Force feels that require an officer rather than enlisted. I don't know what the thinking is there, but but that's the way a lot of decisions were made.
Sure, sure. Okay, now in June of 1954, you graduated this latest school.
Right.
And got married in the process. So you
got married before I graduated.
Right. So you've been very, very busy here. Now, what was it that you hoped to do in your career? I mean, was the Air Force something you were looking at as a career, as a young married man, or were you just wanting to serve your time and get out and go back to civilian life? What were you hoping to do?
I don't really know. I was just sort of clueless, I guess, just drifting along. I wasn't too set on being on you know, I wasn't gung ho about being military or anything like that. And at one time, after I was a flight engineer, the thought crossed my mind the day I graduated, because the airlines were sitting outside the gate recruiting, saying as soon as you've your obligated tour is up, how would you like to come fly for the airlines as a flight engineer? You know, because at that time they used flight engineers. Well, they replaced the flight engineer with third officers or something like that instead of flight engineers. But that was further down the road. At that time they were taking on flight engineers rather than pilots. So that was a thought in the back of my mind. But mainly it was just you know, I have nothing else in mind, so I'll stay with the Air Force.
Now, by making this decision to stay in the Air Force, of course, being in the military in the mid 1950s, the Cold War is burning at a pretty feverish pace then, the competition between the United States and the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union gets the bomb, and China goes red, and you have the Korean War, and you have all of these things kind of boiling there. Did that ever enter into your calculations about what you wanted to do with your career, that how dangerous it could be in the military at that time, or were you all that focused on these world events?
I didn't worry about the danger. I remember we flew simulated missions of taking the big bomb with us, and you know, flying for 24 hours and all that. And of course we had a specified target, and we did practice runs and things like that, and we loaded weapons and downloaded weapons and those kind of things. Mainly just occupied my time with flying and doing the mission that was the mission of you know, flying and training.
Right. Yeah, a lot of training, it sounds like.
I got quite a few hours in the... I was in the B-36 from 54 through 57, only 3 years. So I don't really recall how many hours of flying time I've gotten that time, but quite extensive. I remember, I think the longest mission was... Of course, B-36, you didn't refuel. I don't think the longest mission I ever flew in B-36 is around 27 hours or something like that.
Now, where were you flying these missions to and around?
Well, some of them were just, you know, around the United States. I know we did fly to England, go to England and come back. We'd go to North Africa, stay there for a while, come back. Our crew, the crew I was on, we went to... Dahran, I believe it was, Saudi Arabia one time. I caught the worst cold I'd ever had in ages because I lived in the air-conditioned quarters and then go outside in the heat. Now, man, I was had one heck of a cold. I remember that.
Now, that brings up a pretty good point. You're making these trips. I mean, obviously, going around the United States, but going to North Africa, going to Saudi Arabia, going to Great Britain. When you would have these layovers, one, how long would they last? And two, what sort of things would you do when you were there?
You stayed around the base. I'd go. You know, you'd go tour. Like I remember, we'd go in North Africa, go to Casablanca and places like that.
Right. Now you said you did this from 1954 through 1957.
Yeah, 57, I guess. Because I'm trying to think of when I went to flight school to pilot training, but I can't recall those dates, and I had to go. Pull the paperworks out here and find out when I started flight training.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say that you were pretty satisfied as a flight engineer and navigator?
No, because, well, I guess I was satisfied, but as the B-36 started to phase out, I took one look at it and said, hey, it's a pilot's Air Force. Time for me to go to pilot school.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to requalify again to go for pilot training.
Well, tell me about that process. I mean, obviously, this is something that's important to you.
Well, at that time, what I have in 7 years, maybe something like that, and I could see that if I'm going to stay, I better go to pilot training, because the only other opportunity, only other job open was to go to Bomb Nav School again, go out to Mather Air Force Base, and upgrade to be a bombardier or navigator on the B-52 or the B-47.
And that didn't appeal to you this time?
That didn't appeal as much as being a pilot, because, you know, it was a pilot's Air Force. It was at that time. I don't think it's kind of changing, but that's another story.
Well, maybe we can get there later. We've got you in 1957 now.
Somewhere in that era, let's see, my daughter was born in 57. Yeah, she was born in 57. Had to turn down one assignment because she was... my wife was due, and I said, I just can't move her, and they said, okay, and then they signed me another one, and I think it's starting in October of 57, and they told me if I didn't take that one and go on that one, I wouldn't get another chance.
Oh, wow.
Because I was getting up there, too, in close to within a year of not being eligible anymore, because I think after 26 years old or something like that, they didn't take you. You couldn't get into flight school. So I went in October of 57 to flight school in Bartow Air Force Base, Bartow Air Base, I guess it was, in Bartow, Florida. It was a civilian-run contract-type school, you know, and did the primary pilot training there.
Well, tell me about primary there at Bartow. What was it like back then?
That was fun. We lived in Lakeland, Florida, which is pretty nice. We lived in a single family dwelling, and I fished a lot there because Lakeland is just right by the name. There was a chain of lakes there that you could go rent a little motorboat and go bass fishing all up and down these lakes. I think that's when I got my son actually started on being a fisherman, because he's really an avid fisherman still today. But he was just a little tight then, and I commuted about, I think it's 10, 11 miles every day to go to flight training. Mm-hmm. And you went a full day, half a day academics, half a day on the flight line.
Okay. Well, what did academics consist of?
Same old thing, went through NAV school.
So it's kind of a refresher for you?
Well, yeah, mainly everything was, you know, sort of a rerun, yeah, mm-hmm. More like that.
Right. Well, what about the time on the flight line? What were you doing on the flight line? Not just flying, I assume.
Mainly flying and waiting around while your buddy if there were three of you at the table, waiting while the other two got their, you know, flight training for the day. And sometimes waiting on the weather to clear up. You know, discussion. Well, you had to memorize a whole bunch of, you know, all kinds of things about your airplane. At that time, our primary trainer was a T-34 Mentor, and then the second airplane after you checked out in that one, after about 30 hours, you went to the T-28, mm-hmm. And that was the same, you know, with the same instructors that we had there.
Now, my understanding is that pilot trainee's relationship with the instructor could actually make or break a potential pilot. Did you find this to be the case?
No, because I got along with the flight instructors I had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the civilian types.
Right.
And of course, by that time by that time I was already a second lieutenant. So. Mm-hmm. So, but quite a few of us were from navigators or whatever you want to call us. Some navigators, some flight engineers who decided that it's better to be a pilot than be a navigator or a flight engineer. So,
mm-hmm.
Quite a few of us in the class were, I guess, you know, we weren't second lieutenants. So they treated us, I guess, a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
Never had any run-ins with any instructors, and always got along good.
Mm, very good. How well did you take to flying? These trainers.
I didn't have any trouble with T-28 or T-34, T-28. I had no problem flying. I ended up, I didn't come out top guy in the class, but I came out in the top 10%.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I had my choice of going to single engine or multi-engine, which some guys didn't have a chance, because multi-engines were seemed to be desired by my guys, and but I wanted to go to single engine anyway, so it didn't make any difference.
So you chose single engine then?
So I chose single engine advanced training. Right.
Were you hoping to go into fighters?
In a way, yes, but I had a little restriction on that, because Mama said we already got two kids, and you know it's, I think she'd rather I'd have gone to transports, but
I'm sure.
But I just didn't want to go to the multi-engine training, and so ended up choosing the single-engine jet training.
Okay, well, where did you go for this training?
Webb Air Force Base in Big Spring, Texas.
Okay, so you went to Webb then. Okay, well, tell me about your time there, training on the single-engine at Webb.
Well, started off first. Flying the airplane wasn't no problem. I couldn't land that doggone little beastie.
What was the problem then?
I think the wheels were, the landing gear was too short, and I couldn't get it down to the runway and find, and after my instructor gave me, he wanted me to solo, and he gave me, I think, two pink slips in a row or something like that, and told me, if I give you a pink slip tomorrow, if you don't land this thing in solo, he says, you're going to go up for a check ride. And I landed that booger.
What you say you landed that booger, what type of plane were you flying?
T-Bird, T-33.
Okay.
And he set me, when he told me they were going to get that third pink slip, if I didn't come around and land it, well, I landed it, so. he said, taxi down the runway, he got out and says, good luck. And I soloed. And from then on, I didn't have any trouble getting through flight training with the T-33.
Mm-hmm. Now, was the T-33 the only plane you flew here at Webb?
Advanced training was the T-33. Right?
Okay. Now, you say you didn't have any problems after this.
No, I didn't have any problems. I didn't have any problems with formation instruments or navigation.
Mm-hmm.
So, got through flight school. I think I was number 7 in the class or something like that. So.
Out of how many?
I don't remember. I just remember my number. I remember I had a choice of going to fighters or go to SAC for B-47s. And talked it over with Mama, and Mama says, well, you were in the Strategic Air Command, the B-36. Why don't you go back to B-47? It's a multi-engine airplane and all that. And so, like a dummy, I picked it.
Now, your wife was certainly...
She's still the boss. She still influences a lot of things, a lot of decisions that are made.
Well, she certainly
rather than rock the boat, why?
Well, a man has to know what fights to pick, you know, that
goes.
Yeah,
go with the flow.
So she didn't want you to go into fighters, even though you
had
this training.
Well, no, because I had two kids, and we got pregnant while we were in flight training, too. So.
Okay. So this would have been the third child for you.
Third child, right.
Okay. And when you get through, your wife and you, I'll say, come to this conclusion that maybe...
Better go to multi-engine bombers. So.
Right, Strategic Air Command and multi-engine. So you say the B-47,
yeah.
I think you said it
was.
That was
the B-47, right.
Okay, now you were trained as a single-engine pilot.
Yeah.
But now you're going to multi-engine.
Multi-engine,
what are you going to do
right.
with SAC? What's going to be your role here?
I'd be a co-pilot there.
Okay. Now, when do you report to Strategic Air Command?
Went to McConnell Air Force Base... in Wichita, where I crewed up with a pilot and bomb navigator, because it was a three-man crew, and we flew our training missions there, and also went to ground school on the B-47, and also I remember going through a nuclear weapons school, which I hadn't gone through before, and even though I'd been around the doggone nuclear weapons and done some weird things back in that B-36 days with nuclear weapons. I'd never been to a weapons school. And I remember that. We went through a weapons school there at Wichita and went through the crew training. And about halfway through, we had a break. It was Christmas time, if I remember. Yeah, Christmas break. And the bomb nav lived in Mississippi, in Holly Springs, and had a car accident on the way home, and we lost him and had to pick up another bomb navigator. And the crew's final assignment was at Little Rock Air Force Base in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned something very briefly. You said that when you were with the B-36s that you did some weird things with nuclear weapons.
Well, we carried them in flight, and back in those days, you had to arm the nuclear weapon in flight, and that job fell to the navigator and the second flight engineer, which I was at that time,
mm-hmm.
most of that time.
So you would have been responsible for.
We set the weapon up so it would be a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we did it with dummies. We didn't do it with the real stuff. So. But we did it with dummy-type bombs.
Even without any kind of training prior to this with the B-47s, you were doing this?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
But by the time I got to 47s, that weapon, the B-36 was carrying, was obsolete and out of commission. Didn't have to do that in-flight arming anymore.
Sure. Well, tell me a little bit about the B-47.
Yeah, that mother was a killer. That I didn't realize. We lost two airplanes while I was, I think I was only there 59 through 62 in 3 years. I know we only lost one really through an accident, but and the other one was lost through pilot error. But B-47, it was supposedly underpowered, but you could fly the wings off of it, because once it got to going, it would go. Because with six jet engines and lightweight, it would fly, get out, get up there and get. And wonderful little airplane to fly, but now,
did you spend much time flying this plane?
I've got almost 1,000 hours. Almost ready. I almost reached the point of checking out in it, and the handwriting on the wall was that B-47 is on its way out, so you might as well do something else.
Well, let me ask you about this. What was it like trying to transition from the smaller single-engine planes to the larger B-47? Did you have any special training?
Not much. Not really. Just the same old thing, same instrument techniques and stuff like that. Flying the airplane was, not a reaction, a little bit different, but it's like driving from a car to a truck or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's basically the same thing,
Okay, so once again, you say that you kind of see that the B-47 is going to be phased out in favor of the B-52. I assume is what you're talking about.
Yep, so dumb me. I volunteered to go B-52s and had to volunteer to go as a co-pilot.
Now, when did you make this decision?
Back about 1962, somewhere in there.
Okay. So you're going to transition to the B-52 now.
Uh-huh.
As part of the Strategic Air Command. Obviously, the B-52 plays the dominant role with SAC in terms of long-range bombing.
Yeah, at that time, it was the airplane.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you think about the B-52 and making this move over?
It was quite an airplane.
Describe it for me. Tell me about it. Some of its characteristics and different things.
Well, I fortunately for me, when I went to Mather Air Force Base, not Mather, where was it? I don't even remember where I went. We went somewhere in Merced, and I don't know what the place was. We went there for the B-52 upgrade, and the pilot I went with had no problem with refueling, so I got to learn to refuel, and that was the main thing that I really got out of the B-52 right away was, man, I can fly formation with this tanker and take on all this fuel from a tanker, and it's kind of neat. So now it was just it was completely different. Having a crew was quite a deal, and sort of like a little closed community. Didn't get along too well with some people, but I guess I was an irritant to a lot of people. About
how many crew members was on the B-52?
B-52 was six. The B-52G. We had two pilots, bomb nav, navigator, and they launched electronics warfare and a gunner. That's the same airplane that flew, a linebacker in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
over North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So we flew. That was the normal crew. On some missions you always carry. You had maybe a couple extras, maybe an extra nav, maybe an extra pilot, whatever.
Mm-hmm. What was it like being part of Strategic Air Command? Like you say, this is 1962, of course. 62 with the Cuban Missile Crisis in October.
Well,
did that affect you at all?
Let's see, the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think I was still in the B-47. I know I was.
Okay.
Cuban Missile Crisis. Well, we took our B-47 to Terre Haute, Indiana. with a big old bomb on board. And stayed there through the duration of that thing.
Now, what did you think about that? As someone who could potentially have been very much involved in an attack on Cuba,
we weren't aimed to Cuba. We were aimed the other way.
Okay, going the other way, going over the North Pole into the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So, well, tell me about that then.
Well, I think most guys that were crew members on the B-47, B-52 were resigned to the fact that they were going to fly a one-way mission. That was probably about it.
Were you resigned to this fact, too?
You knew if it was a real thing, your chances of getting there and getting back were, you know, mighty, mighty slim.
You're a married man with at least two children, maybe one on the way.
That's one thing you didn't think about.
Okay.
Well, at that time, they, you know, the Russian defenses that when I started B-47 weren't that strong, but as the 60s came along, their air defense became a lot stronger,
mm-hmm.
And you knew that you weren't going to, you're either going to run out of fuel or you were going to get taken out on the way in or way out,
mm-hmm.
Because by that time the Russians had, you know, many, many, many fighters.
Right.
And lots of ground anti-aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, they also knew a lot about what we were doing.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Their intelligence is
their intelligence was up to date with what we were, what was going on. And but in the 1960s, you know, they caught up with us in the atomic age and the delivery airplanes and fighters and all that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been in the Air Force for a little over 10 years now.
I'm thinking about getting out, but I didn't.
Okay, now why were you thinking that serious? Why were you thinking about getting out?
I didn't like Strategic Air Command.
What was it about SAC that you didn't like?
I guess just the fact that you were tied down. Same old routine, and it wasn't that inspiring. I just wasn't that concerned about being, you know, involved with delivering weapons to targets in Russia.
Right.
And it's difficult because you spent time on alert, you got time off, and it was just a confined career, I guess, is what you'd say. Wasn't any thrill to it. I mean, you were stationed at a base, and yeah, that was it. I mean, probably a different life. One you had to really have a personality to adjust to and like.
Well, you mentioned that it was kind of confined in terms of your career. I would assume, like you say, there are certain times when you're standing down, sometimes other times when you're not, when you're constantly ready, these very, very long missions. And like you said, these missions would maybe be one-way missions, so doesn't sound like there'd be an awful lot of variety or an awful lot of excitement, and the one piece of excitement that would come was excitement that you wouldn't want.
That's right. That's probably it.
Now, were you considering just getting out of SAC, which had its
own
difficulties?
No, I thought maybe just getting out of the service, period.
Okay. Now, it never crossed your mind to maybe stay in the Air Force but leave Strategic Air Command?
No. I didn't think about that. Getting out of SAC was kind of tough. The way I got out of SAC was I got that assignment as a forward air controller from Air Force. So, once I got that, it didn't take but about 2 months to get the decision made that it was a way out.
Well, give me the timeline here, if you will, Mr. Bremenkamp. You're fed up with the Strategic Air Command, considering getting out of the Air Force altogether, but yet this forward air controller opportunity comes up. When does this happen? Take me through this.
This happened in probably in the early, probably the middle summer of 65.
Okay.
Orders came from Air Force nominating me to the first one, I guess, out of our squadron to go out as a forward air controller. I was a senior captain by that time. I'd been a captain for, I was on, you know, in the zone for, I guess in the zone for major at that time even. So I was, and I don't know what they looked at as criteria, but there was my name on the list. And of course, there I was. I'd been flying that B-47, that B-52, and I'd finished my check ride as an aircraft commander. I did my low-level mission. I did my refueling mission. I did my instrument check, and I did my crew checkout, passed everything, and was put up as an aircraft commander without a crew because there wasn't a crew available at the time. And here come these orders to go to Southeast Asia Forward Air Control, and the wing commander said, no way, you can't go because we've invested all this money and time upgrading you as an aircraft commander. We'll just get those orders canceled. And somewhere in August, it had to be in August, I think, I got put on alert. And I'll be doggone if I didn't get put for a week, and I'll be doggone when it came time to get relieved, I got put on alert again for another week. At the end of those 2 weeks, I called the wing commander as soon as I got off of alert and said, I don't even remember his name, could we quit fighting those orders as a forward air controller and let me get out of here on my way? He says, I'll get with them and find out and get what you want, if that's what you want. And I said, that's what I want. And I got off alert at about 9 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He called me up and says, Bremen Camp, you're on your way to Southeast Asia. So I got out of sight.
Wow. Now, let me ask you a few questions here. One is, did you put in for this forward air controller position?
No, that was an involuntary assignment.
Okay, so what was it about you that they identified? You're flying B-52.
I think the fact that I was a senior captain.
Mm-hmm.
See, I'm checking my flight log here right now. I see my last B-52 ride with flight was in October. October 13th, and I didn't fly any more B-52 missions. I flew all that mission as a first pilot.
Okay,
so they must have let me fly on flight as an aircraft commander. How about that? And then I didn't fly again until November 16th, and I flew in a KC-135. And on 20 November, that was my last flight with a SAC airplane. And I didn't fly again until December. So I sat around. I mean, they took me off a crew and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't fly again until December.
Now, you mentioned that they had you on alert for the first time, then they had you on alert again the second time. Was this Strategic Air Command's way of fighting this and of keeping you there to retrieve
their
investment?
You'd always spend a week on alert, at least every, rotation on alert. But there was nobody to take to. Some crew was short, either a co-pilot or an aircraft commander, and I ended up pulling back-to-back alert
mm-hmm.
duties.
Okay. Now, you finally get your way. You're finally out of Strategic Air.
I'm out of sight. Thank goodness.
Now, let me ask you this. I've heard other pilots say that it was very, very difficult to get out of Strategic Air Command, and you've related part of that to me. I've also heard them say that as a result of their leaving this fraternity, if you will, of Strategic Air Command, that it had a somewhat negative impact on their career in terms of
evaluation. Oh, yeah. I was passed over for major.
As a result of your wanting to leave SAC?
I think so. Didn't get a good ER when I left there,
mm-hmm.
and I think it impacted my. I didn't get promoted till the next year. I missed out by 1 year. I got my celebrating my first Passover while I was in training to be a forward air controller, and I think getting out of SAC probably might have been that because I remember the wing commander saying, Glenn, he says, As soon as you finish your tour as a FAC, you can come back here, and we'll put you back in the Bay 52, you know. And I said under my breath, it will be a very cold day before I come back to SAC. That was under my breath, but he might have seen my lips move. I don't know.
A very cold day in Hurlburt Field, huh?
Right.
So, okay, now, you managed to escape Strategic Air Command. When did you officially leave SAC and start training
for
Border Control?
I must have left in I don't know when I left, because I got November 16th as I flew a KC-135 to get my flight time.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, in October I flew my last B-52 mission. And then I didn't fly again. My Form 5 here says I didn't fly again until December the 20th at Hurlburt. Hurlburt was Holly Field, of course. Holly Field, I flew there on December the 20th of 1965. So I didn't hardly fly an airplane from November through... from October, November, you know, one flight in November. Last flight, October 13th. I flew November 15th, and I didn't fly again until December of 65. So I sat around doing nothing there. Probably took a little bit of leave, and I sat around doing nothing there for almost a full month.
Hmm.
Or more than that, I really didn't do nothing from October till December 20th.
That's a
long
time.
I started training in the 01.
That's a very long time for a pilot to not be flying.
Yeah, but I'm looking right here at my Form 5. The first day I flew the 01, I did 55 landings.
55?
55 landings first day.
My goodness, what was the reason for this high number of landings?
I guess because they let me fly the airplane.
Okay.
Flew 6 hours that day and did 55 landings.
My goodness.
That really learned how to fly the airplane.
Now, let me ask you some very general questions here, or just to start this whole process of going to forward air control training. Was there anything about the facts that appealed to you? Did you know much about the mission or the overall approach?
Well, you know,
facts?
Read up on it after I got the assignment and everything. Mm-hmm. Knew it was a dangerous mission, but also knew it was going to be, you know, was quite a different mission from anything else that the Air Force was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, something to look forward to.
One of the things that you mentioned a while ago was that the routine became a little stale with Strategic Air Command, but as a forward air controller, that would certainly not be the case.
That's for sure, because once you ended up flying your combat missions, well, it was quite different.
Mm-hmm. Well, take me through your training. Where were you trained as a forward air controller?
Well, wherever other FAC went through, Hurlburt Field.
Right.
You know.
Okay. Well,
and,
take me through that training.
Well, I think I slept most of the time during the ground courses. I do recall we did get what they called AGOS, Air Ground Observer, Air Ground Observer or something like that, AGOS, and we went through that course. A lot of stuff I guess I should have paid attention to, but didn't, because mainly just, you know, really turned loose, having a good time. Partied every night, and flew every day. And
did your family move down to...
No, they got to stay. My family, fortunately, I was at Seymour Johnson. We had the B-52s, where it was owned by an F-105 wing.
Mm-hmm.
And before I left, the wing commander set it up so my wife and family got to stay in base quarters on Seymour Johnson for the full year I was overseas in Vietnam. So that was a very good deal. So they did come down at Christmas time. We spent Christmas week off because I think we only had about 4 or 5 days off at Christmas time, but ended up coming down there and staying in a motel with the family during that Christmas break. And just mainly just flying a lot.
Now this is late 65 and into early 1966. I assume that you are training, you're trying to check out in the 01, the bird dog, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, tell me about that plane. You've gone from the biggest plane that the Air Force has to arguably the smallest.
That's right.
That it has. What was that like for you?
It was. I don't know. It's like turning a kid loose at a candy store, I
really?
Guess. Because here's an airplane. You got it to yourself again. You're it. I mean, there's nobody else to depend on. Nobody else to be responsible for. I mean, it's your airplane, and you get to fly it and do what you want to do. And it was just being turned loose with an airplane that was fun to fly.
I assume that you had very little problem in terms of flight training with the O-1, of checking out.
I only ground looped it once, and that was when they told me to expedite the runway and did a ground loop and big cloud of dust and didn't hit the wingtip on the ground and taxied away from it. So that was the closest I came to having an accident in it.
Now, you're doing well in the flight. You say you weren't paying that much attention in ground school.
I guess I didn't. I don't remember.
You've been through so
far back there.
Right. You've been through so much of this stuff before, and you've been flying very complicated, complex planes. And
yeah, here we got an airplane that's got a stick and throttle and a mixture control. And I do remember that they did have the O-1F, which had a variable pitch prop on it, too. So
mm-hmm.
There were two different types, the O-1E and the O-1F.
Okay. Well, I've heard other pilots talk to me about this before. They've told me about this. But this variable pitch, explain to me what you mean by that and how...
Well, you can change the angle of the propeller. And if you change the angle of the propeller, you can do, you know, get more airspeed and... save fuel and all, have better power for takeoffs and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't tell me we got a storm going on out here. You sure do. Oh, boy, it's pouring.
Oh, is that right? Biloxi's getting some more rain.
This part of Biloxi's getting rain anyway. That's probably part of the offshoot of that little tropical storm over there in Florida.
Right.
Yeah, we had a 60% chance today, so I see we've gotten 60% of it's on us, I guess.
Well, you mentioned again you're not having problems with the flying of the O-1. You're really enjoying that by the sounds of it.
It was a good airplane to fly.
Your ground school doesn't mean much to you considering everything else you've been through. But what about the mission of the facts? Are your instructors telling you what's going to happen, what's going on, how you're going to approach things? Obviously, you can't know until you're there.
Really don't think they knew that much since they weren't experienced at that time. You know, at that time, the FAC program was just, I was in class 6505, so there probably hadn't been too many classes before that because there weren't but a handful of facts in Southeast Asia in 64 and 65.
Mm-hmm.
So those of us that started there in 66, started getting over there in 65, late 65 and 66 were the first guys getting a lot of experience. Actually, as far as combat flying went and everything, the ground school didn't quite cover. What they covered more than anything else was communications, you know, and all that. Well, yeah, the communication setup was all right, but the other thing was that you actually were out there flying, and all, you know, main thing that the ground school taught was lines of communication, lines of command, and how you got your airplanes for your airstrikes and coordination with the Army and stuff like that. And so the ground school was not geared toward combat at that time. I don't know how it was, you know, how it evolved later on. It may have changed some.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know.
Well, I think it would stand to reason that as some of these facts finished
come
their
back,
tours,
yeah, they came back as instructors.
Yes.
Yeah, they would.
And have a better idea about communications and about coordination, all the things that made the facts.
Well,
mission
another thing I kept thinking about, I got over there and went to Tonsonute, of course, to headquarters, and I got assigned as an air liaison officer/FAC. Well, I don't remember. I can't remember anything at ground school telling us what the duties of deal and what an air liaison officer was really responsible for. I had to play that by ear once I got, you know, out in the boondocks and assigned to a province.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get you to Vietnam, a few more questions here back home. One, and most importantly, I think, for right now, your wife encouraged you to leave the fighters behind you. Now, you've got orders for Vietnam, and not only are you not in a fighter, you're moving, you're several thousand feet closer to the ground, and you're moving at about 100 miles an hour.
She wasn't too happy.
I was going to ask you, what was her reaction to this?
She just wasn't too happy about it, but I think she knew that I'd had my fill of being, you know, in the flight job I was in. It wasn't much. She didn't protest it. She says, "That's what you want to do. Go ahead and do it." And so that was it.
Okay. Now, also, this is very early in the beginning of the American buildup in Vietnam.
Yeah.
What did you know, if anything, maybe I should ask you this: how closely were you following U.S. involvement, the events in Vietnam?
Oh, fairly close. We knew that, you know, that it was a counterinsurgency type war, and we were fighting it a lot different than the conflict in Korea was fought. So it wasn't that much concerned in my mind about what was taking place at that time.
Okay, now when do you finish your training there at Hurlburt and go to the West Coast to leave for Vietnam?
I got my Form 5 in front of me. I see my last flight there was January the 17th. I remember being home on the 19th of January, because I had from the 19th till about the first day or two of February or something like that, to spend before I went over to Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up in middle of January of 66, finished training there at Hurlburt.
And it's not until early February that you have to report for duty.
Yeah, I think I had to report over there February 2nd, but that just sort of sticks in my mind, and I'm not too sure.
Now, a report in Saigon?
In Saigon, at Tonsonu, yeah.
Okay. So you leave the U.S. late January of 1966, or very early February, the 1st of February.
Yeah, probably the 1st.
Okay. Now, what was it like? Again, this is very early in American involvement, the buildup here. What was it like on the trip over to Vietnam? Describe that trip over for me.
Well, the only two only people saw me off was wife and three kids at a little airport outside down there in North Carolina. Flew to Chicago. I flew commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Flew Chicago. Had a holdover in Chicago. I remember I was ill prepared. I had nothing with me but summer uniform, and it was cold as the dickens in Chicago because it was February, and spent several hours there waiting on my flight. Flew on out, I think nonstop to I don't even know what the takeoff base is. Was it a base or an airfield? I think. Well, somewhere. Coming off the top of my head, I can't remember. It was an air base out in California. I know that. Where I was to catch a commercial flight to Nam. The only thing I remember about that trip is nobody paid any attention to you, you know.
When you say nobody, do you mean people at the airport? Or?
People at the airport, no, you know. People at the airport. I got to the air base, and everybody loaded up on the airplane, and away she went. It was Continental Airlines. I know. The airplane we went over on was Continental Airlines. I don't even know what type of airplane it was outside of a jet.
Did you have any concerns, any anxiety, any trepidation about making this one-year tour in Vietnam?
Heck no. Shoot, no. I was going over there to kick butt.
Is that right?
I was going to do my thing. Hey, they made you, through the little training down there at Herbert, they made you sort of gung-ho for the program.
What you'd have to
do. Especially when you got a taste of, putting in airplanes with live bombs and stuff like that, in practice. Well, that's where they got you wound up, ready to do it.
Mm-hmm. How old were you at this time?
Oh, hey, I was an old man at that time. I was 32 years old. Well, I turned 33 in March of that year of 66.
That is an old man, I guess, for the circumstances.
Compared to all these kids that came on as facts later on, just out of college and out of flight training and out of the Air Force Academy and places like that, they were young.
Mm-hmm.
They were a lot more gung-ho than me. Of course, we were... The first cadres were older. We don't understand why, but most of us were older, more experienced pilots. And we've talked about and discussed it. Why did they pick us? We don't really know. Outside the fact that they did not want to dip down. They wanted people who had been flying airplanes for a while, I guess. I don't know why we were chosen.
Do you think that maybe the maturity level would have been
something? It might have been the maturity level and that. And they knew that you were going to be out there, on your own, and you had to think. And they want people who thought things through, I guess.
Right. Okay, now you are headed to Saigon. You're going to fly into Tan Son, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
When you get to Vietnam, what are your first impressions? You walk off this commercial flight. What are your first impressions of the country?
What the heck am I doing here?
Why do you say that?
Well, it was strange. Like, hey, you've arrived. We're gonna put you up. Get on the bus here. We're gonna take you to some quarters, and you can catch some sleep. A couple of days, we'll come by. We'll send a car, somebody out here for you, pick you up. Just sit back and relax and wait till we come pick you up, and they get your in-country briefing, and we'll issue all your equipment and give you your assignment. And that took about, I guess, 3 or 4 days, something like that.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the in-country briefing. What did the in-country briefing consist of in February of 1966? Do you remember?
I don't remember at all. All I remember is getting a gamma globin shot, and because they told us we had to have them every so often. Anyway, Lieutenant Colonel I knew and myself and somebody else, we went and got our gamma globin shots, and we swore up and down that was the last thing we was going to get because it hurt so bad.
I've heard that.
And man, they stuck that needle, a big old horse needle in your butt, and shoo! That was the last gamma globin shot I ever got. I don't know whether the rest did. I know they didn't either.
40-some-odd years later, that still sticks pretty clearly.
It still sticks in my mind of that gamma globin shot. Man, that was something else.
Did you receive your orders where you're going to report at this time?
Yeah, they sent me down as an air liaison officer/forward air controller for Kinjiang Province Kinjiang is the name of the province, and Rockjaw was the name of the province capital, and I was assigned to a MACV team, 55. I had another pilot there waiting. My whole command was another pilot, a radio operator, and a crew chief, and I was liaison officer to the VNAF. Not to the VNAV, really to the Arvin Army guy, to the province chief.
Okay.
And I had to give the briefing, the morning briefing, every day what we'd done and what transpired and what we were going to do for that day. And they tell me what support that we needed, and I'd have to get back with the desk and find out, whether we could get airplanes or whether we needed airplanes or if they had anything planned for the area So I covered a province, I don't know how big it was, maybe 15 miles, 20 wide by about 30 miles or so long, right on the Gulf of Siam. Wonderful place for seafood. And the only other Americans there stationed there was on the Cambodian border was a Special Forces advisory team.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the MACV team had, since it was on the Gulf, on the coast down there, we had Navy, Air Force, and Army representing both, because the Navy worked with the boats that the South Vietnamese had there in that area. And it was about 60 of us total there in the province.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time, while I was only there from, February through March, middle of February through March, and we only had one operation the whole time I was there. They brought Rangers, Arvin Rangers in and dropped them off in helicopters, and they swept through a bunch of rice paddies and never made contact with whoever they were supposedly chasing. I don't know whether it was maybe more, it became more of a training exercise than it did anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about the big thing there was fly every day, check the province, make sure, just see if there was any change. The biggest excitement was right after I got there, this Navy, the Swift boat. I don't know if you know what the Swift boat was.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we had a Swift boat ensign who decided that this Viet Cong flag on a pole, bamboo pole out there in the water, didn't really belong there. And he didn't know it had a 500-pound bomb underneath it.
I was going to ask if that were the case.
And that's what, and must have been sitting right over it when they detonated it, because it blew the belt, ammo belts right out of the turret. It took 2 days to find the gunner's body. It killed, I forget how many they had on crew, 4 or 5. Anyway, he and the radio operator, the engine and the radio operator, the only two survivors. And that was my first SAR mission. I didn't even know it was a SAR mission. I ended up coordinating, getting an Army helicopter in to pick these two, the engine up. He was wounded. The radio operator had broken legs, but he survived because he was behind something, he said.
Mm-hmm.
And poor old little ensign got court-martialed when they got him out of the hospital. But I think he learned a lesson. Don't mess with Viet Cong flags.
Yeah.
But he drove that boat right up to it, and of course they had it booby-trapped. We spent, I guess, about 3 or 4 days getting that boat out of there. Plus, the first thing was to try to find the gunner. And once he was found, well, then they had to get the boat out of there. And we put in airstrikes because they kept shooting from the shoreline at the recovery crews out there. And that was the first airstrikes I got to put, actual airstrikes I got to put in. Outside that, the other airstrikes were just missions that were already targeted, by the province chief. Said, we bomb here. It's just, that was it. And well, and the Special Forces, I like to support them. It was kind of hairy because you had to land right by the Cambodian border and then had to go 2 or 3 miles to get to where the Special Forces camp was. And you leave 3 or 4 Arvin guys out there guarding your airplane and hope it was still there when you got back. after you went and talked to the Special Forces guy, and they were always sending us out there with special communiques, can't put it on the radio, so you got to carry it out there to them,
So you would actually leave your plane, go out and find these guys, or they would.
Well, they had a fort set up, a base camp,
Right, a little A camp, I guess.
A little A camp, and they had their Claymore mines set around it and all that, and the machine guns, And I had some pictures of it, and I don't know, I can't find them at all for some reason. Can't find some stuff. Can't find any. Find a lot of things. Can't find my diary. That was the worst thing. I lost my diary. It had to be in this house somewhere, but it disappeared within a year after I got back and moved in this house, and it It's been gone ever since.
Wow, what a shame.
Well, it wasn't a real complete diary, but it had a lot of little memorandums in it, but it's gone.
Hmm.
It probably got thrown out with the trash one day.
It would be great to be able to recover that one these days.
All I can do is try to remember things, and then I remember them wrong. So.
Well, Mr. Rimmenkamp, why don't we take a break there for today?
Okay.
This is Kelly Kreger continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Glenn Bremenkamp. Today is 21 August 2009. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Bremenkamp is joining me by telephone from his home in Biloxi, Mississippi. All right, Mr. Bremenkamp, when we last left off, we had just got you to Southeast Asia. We got you at Rockjaw with the 22nd TAS. Now, your time here was a short time, about a month and a half, as you mentioned, and you're serving as Air Liaison Officer /FAC. Can you go ahead and, if you would, tell me a little bit about your duties and responsibilities as Air Liaison Officer? You just mentioned that you're working not with American troops, but with ARVN troops. Can you tell me some more about your time there as ALO?
Okay, the ALO, we were attached to the MACV Team 55,
mm-hmm.
which was headed up by an Army colonel. We had the Army MACV team, we had the a Navy group in there because we were on the Gulf of Siam, and of course, our little Air Force contingent of myself, a FAC, and radio operator, and aircraft maintenance guy. We had 101E, and the Air Force, Army had an 01E, which an Army pilot by the name of Norm Savar flew very erratically. he was gung-ho. He got grounded a couple times by the commander. But my main job was, keeping contact with the ARVN S3, which is the intelligence officer, and he was a lieutenant, not too keen on being out, getting exposed, because I took him on one flight, and they had briefed that there was a 12.7 or 51 caliber machine gun at this location on the canal, and sure enough there was, and he fired a few rounds at us, and I jinked around and watched him for a while, and he never hit us, and the Arvinist, this little lieutenant, called me a cowboy and said he'd never fly with me again, and he didn't. I mean, he flew one flight, that was it, he wouldn't go up with me again. So I got me assigned a little sergeant with a carbine. He had about half a dozen shiny little bullets that he carried around. He didn't have any more ammo for the gun than that, but that was his weapon. And he flew in the back seat and was my communication because he was understood enough English that he could interpret for me.
Okay. Now, were you in contact during your time in the air? Were you in contact with ARVN troops on the ground?
The only ARVN troops ever in contact with was a little operation that they had with the Rangers they brought in by helicopter.
Okay. Yeah, you mentioned that.
That was the only operation we had. I did work with Special Forces guys on about two or three occasions where I was airborne and they would call and say, we've got contact, and try to get airstrike, which was really didn't work, but we did do one coordinated strike where they had located a base camp of Viet Cong out in along a sort of river, what I guess I would call a creek down here, but they had a bunch of hidden little buildings and everything, and the Army brought in about four helicopters and myself, and I went in and marked the target for them, and fired all four of my rockets into the brush line and into these, you could see the hooches and buildings down inside the jungle, and they attacked them for a period of time. I think the Viet Cong had already evacuated the area before the airstrike,
mm-hmm.
because they didn't have any body count of any type. One other time, the Special Forces guys were out and way out in an open area, so somehow, some way, it was the VNAF Air Force,
mm-hmm.
with four A-1s had spotted them. And the first thing they did was they made a pass at them, and I get this frantic call from the captain of the Special Forces saying, "You've got to save us. These guys are going to try to kill us." And I said, "What's going on?" And I headed toward them. They said, "Well, they made a pass at us, but we're afraid they're going to fire on us." So I got there, and I got myself between them and the VNAF and tried to contact them. I couldn't make contact. Finally found what frequency they were on through the control, through my radio operator, and tried to talk to them, and nobody answered. And finally, they pulled off the target. And as they were pulling off the target, I heard this voice, "Okay, FAC, we're leaving the area. You're okay." I said, "What the heck is going on?" Turns out there was an American pilot in the number 4 airplane, and he was not able to stop these guys from... He wasn't able to communicate enough to stop these guys from scaring my Special Forces. Of course,
wow.
Special Forces guys had about 20 to 30 of the Arvin irregular forces with them, and,
mm-hmm.
of course, they saw all these troops out there on the ground. They thought they were, you know, the enemy, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So they were a little... pretty pleased that we'd saved their... But the big problem at that time in the province was the province chief ruled that province.
Mm-hmm.
He was like a little petty king, I guess. And, of course, he got his kickbacks from protection of different things in the province. The big thing he got money from was a cement plant that was about 5 or 6 miles from Rockjaw. And that was under his big protection, so... He protected them and he got a payback. And he did get transferred to another job. I don't remember much about the new guy that came in, because probably about that time is when I left. But it was interesting being there. A few little operations like that. And mainly just everyday things, you know, get up, go fly visual reconnaissance, drop leaflets, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to win the hearts and minds, which was a fallacy. You weren't going to win the hearts and minds bombing these people and shooting at them.
Mm-hmm.
I did fly a night flight in a helicopter, which must not have been in my right mind. I got on board with these Army guys, and we flew a night mission. I don't know what we were looking for. We went out and back, and you can't tell anything. Couldn't see anything at night, but I don't know what the whole big deal was on that, but I don't know why I did it either, but I did.
Well, let me back up here a little bit. You talked about this, these two missions, if you will, dealing with U.S. Special Forces. Of course, there are indigenous personnel working with the American Special Forces there. The first time you said that that they thought they had engaged the enemy. Now, were you apprised of their being out there? Were you made aware that the Special Forces team was going to be in the region and they were going to be
working there? No, I did not know that they were out on operation of any type. Just they were lucky that I was airborne and in their vicinity when these VNAF guys thought they were the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they got on the radio immediately to my Arvin guy, you know, on his radio, because I didn't have communication. But through the interpreter to them, I finally found out a frequency I could talk on.
Mm-hmm.
And we got it untangled and got the VNAF out of there.
So you were just up flying?
Just up flying,
just
a visual mission,
recon.
Right.
Okay.
Wasn't a special operation of any kind. The only special one was a special operation before we went after the base camp.
Mm-hmm. And what you said was overall was a failure.
We destroyed their base camp, but they could rebuild that in the next week probably.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now as the air liaison officer, you're going to have to deal with units that are on the ground, helping to coordinate some sort of air support, air cover for whatever you may be involved in or whatever
that
may be involved.
Communication with the Direct Air Support Center. They would frag missions to. If we asked for them, and
mm-hmm.
if the province chief asked for them, what we called, you know, the desk, and I would call the desk, or the other FAC would get, if he was around, he'd call the desk, and we'd try to get the desk to schedule us, you know, air support for the province chief.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I was a little leery of what kind of targets he selected, but...
Okay, now, that's very interesting you should say that. Now, you're going to be, because these are largely an Arvin unit with which you're dealing, What was your relationship like with the, you said it was the S3 with whom you were dealing, right?
No problem with him. He just didn't want to fly with me.
Mm-hmm. But other than that, there were no problems?
No problems.
Communication problems or their attitude to your being there or your attitude
toward
them?
No, they wanted, liked the idea of us being there because, you know, they got to, I guess, in my estimation, sometimes it was just punishment for not really conforming to the way the province chief wanted things to go. And I was leery of a couple airstrikes that he had us put in, but tried to limit the collateral damage on a strike like that.
Sure, sure. So you have to you coordinate with the Arvin unit, then
right.
You call in DASC, and you try to find some sort of a middle ground here on bombing targets, but you say they all have to be approved by the province chief.
Right, province
and the province chief could also initiate.
He initiated the target. And
okay.
Now
you said that you were leery of some of the targets that he would promote. Why was this the case?
Well, I think just like most of the corrupt government in South Vietnam, that he was expecting kickback from the people he was, you know, protecting.
Mm-hmm.
And if he didn't get it quick enough, well, I guess he prompted them a little bit.
So do you suspect that he was bringing in air power against targets as a form of
intimidation?
For intimidation?
Yeah, I'm sure. Not being able to really understand his thoughts and what his motives were, but
mm-hmm.
very suspicious.
Now you said that he was certainly trying to protect this concrete plant.
Yeah, the cement plant. Yeah, because it was a very lucrative business.
And it was Vietnamese owned, I assume.
It was Vietnamese owned, right?
Okay, and you certainly suspect that the protection of that was a result of his paying. For the protector, or their paying.
Certainly he did, because he stationed a lot of his regular forces, you know, around the cement plant in order to keep the Viet Cong from damaging it or hurting it in any way.
Okay, now let's just go the other
way
with that.
That's one of his priority protection zones.
Sure. Well, let's go the other way with that now. You said that some of the ones that he would call in were somewhat suspicious. What types of missions would he call in? What kinds of air power would he call in? And on what
types of
targets?
Well, usually
we
got F-100s.
F-100s.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And what types of targets would he be going after?
Either structures or, in some cases, he said, I don't like the way they've got a concentration of water buffalo in this area or something like that, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And you bring him in, and then, of course, as you said, you would try to limit the collateral damage despite the suspicions you had. Because of the suspicions you had, you tried to limit the damage that these sorts of things could do. That's very, very interesting. Did you ever press your concerns up to any higher level while you were there?
No. Wouldn't have done much good because they wanted to get that air power out and show that we were, you know, providing our ordnance on target as requested.
Sure, and of course he's province chief, and they, like you say, they hold an awful lot of power.
Oh man, yes.
For sure.
Huh. And it would have got back, you know.
Now you'd also mentioned this one insertion of Arvin Rangers. Can you take me through that mission? You said that it didn't really result in anything, but can you take me through that mission? How you
were
trying to coordinate?
Well, it was interesting to watch
things?
Them bring the helicopters in, and all these little guys got out, and every one of them had a red bandana around his neck, and they take off running through the rice paddies and finally get to through the zone that they wanted to get through, and they regrouped and picked them up and went back on home.
Was there any enemy fire this entire time?
Not that I know of.
Okay. Now, were you flying in the area?
Yes, yeah, right.
And you, I guess it was just visual reconnaissance that
just,
you were
yeah,
doing
just
there.
Visually seeing what, you know, if it, what was going on.
Mm-hmm. And so it was a clear landing, a clear LZ, clear landing zone. They came in, they hit the ground. Essentially, no one found anything. Then they picked them up, and that was it. Then
that was yeah.
Okay.
That was the only one I saw like that. But that was probably typical of a lot of things that the Arvin initially operated on. But it was good. It was probably more of a training exercise and overall results, you know, than anything else.
How much contact did you have with the Arvin as the ALO here? Daily
well,
contact?
Well, just the ones that were stationed there in Rockjaw themselves. Mm-hmm. Just the private chief, his staff.
Okay. What was your relationship like with the Vietnamese personnel in general? What was your impression of them?
They were good people. They wanted to get rid of the Viet Cong, but it was a problem that they just didn't have the firepower, the intelligence control of the area in order to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So once you got outside the ring of wherever there were troops stationed, why, the Viet Cong had full reign because they would like setting the Viet Cong flag out there in the Gulf of Siam out in the shallow water. After the Swift Boat incident, why, within a day or two, they had another flag out there on a flagpole after we got the Swift Boat out of there, you know, and everything. They put another one out there. Of course, we tried to shoot it up with rockets, but you can't, when you fly an 01, you don't have a very accurate rocket.
Right.
Well, so it still stood there.
Well, tell me a little bit, and you mentioned this last time, especially during your training at Hurlburt, but here you are in Vietnam in an 01. Tell me about your what it took to fly this plane, how you would approach it, the types of things you would do, the weapons you would carry. Take me through your typical 01. I believe you said they were 01Fs you flew most of the time.
Well, these were 01Es.
These were 01Es. Okay. Well, take me through a tour of a typical flight for you as ALO with the 01.
Well, by the time we got out to fly the airplane, the crew chief already had it ready to go and had the rockets loaded, and all you had to do is do a walk around and crank up, and the airstrip was a north-south roadway, and with another crossroad going through it, and the little old Arvin army guys would block traffic while you went taxi down the end of the road toward the water and turn around and make your takeoff, and they'd block traffic while you made your takeoff. And of course, the same thing when you came back to land, you'd buzz them and they'd stop traffic so you could land. We had about 700 feet, I guess, of roadway to take off and land on.
I've never heard of that, using an actual road to do this.
Yeah, we didn't. It wasn't a runway; it was a roadway. Went right past the graveyard on one side of it, which was very interesting. And then about 100 yards off the end of the runway, we had the rice paddies, and we had a little old guy used to sit out there and take a pot shot at us. And they said, leave him alone, because he hadn't hit at the airplane yet. So nobody bothered him.
Was he Viet Cong, or was he just
He had to be a Viet Cong, I mean, or he just a disgruntled farmer, one of the two.
Right, right.
But he never hit the airplane, so left him alone.
What was he shooting at you with?
We figured it was an old carbine or an old old rifle of World War II vintage.
Sure. Okay. That's funny. Now, you say that there was an Army 01 and
an Army
another
01.
Fact.
The Army had an 01 there, too.
So there were three of you there, or three planes, three 01s there.
Two 01s.
Two
01s. Army had one, we had one.
Oh, okay. So the other fact would share one with you, is that
right.
The case? Okay.
We shared that airplane.
Okay, I've got you. Now, were you going out on any sort of night flights, night missions?
I think I was airborne once or twice at night. We did not patrol at night.
Mm-hmm.
Outside, I do remember watching, seeing the, that's 40 years ago, blank. The Puff the Magic Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
I saw one of them working one night.
What was that like?
That was a real fireworks display.
That's what I understand. What was the occasion for this? Why was
I don't know. He was several miles away. I never did find out what, he wasn't in my province.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what he was shooting at or whatever.
Okay. What sort of weapons did you carry on the 01?
I carried a 38 and a M16.
For your personal weapons you did?
My personal weapons.
Okay.
That was it.
And did you have, like, I would guess, the white phosphorus rockets
on? Yeah, the Willie Pete
Willie Pete
rockets, yeah.
Okay, and what, four of those, I would assume?
Four, yeah.
Okay.
We weren't equipped with eight, like some, like later on, some of the old ones were equipped with eight rocket pods.
Mm-hmm.
But we only had four at that time.
Okay, now tell me about flying. You're a few hundred feet off the deck. You're going at roughly 100 miles an hour. What sort of tactics did you take in your flying, low and slow, as it were? How would you compensate for the lack of speed and the lack of altitude?
There was no real ground threat in this province, so I mainly just flew straight and level.
Mm-hmm.
And never, if I got shot at, it was probably small arms. I never got hit in that month and a half that I was flying there. So, and I'm sure I was shot at several times, but nothing. Make contact with the air machine.
Mm-hmm. Sustained no damage then.
No damage
from the small arms fire
at all. So I may have been shot at, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, flying a straight line, I'm sure, wouldn't serve your purposes later on. But now it was okay to do so.
Yeah, there was no anti-aircraft threat. The only problem might have been as closer to the camp, it was right. The province was right on the Cambodian border, and there might have been something there, but I never strayed over into Cambodia. So.
Oh, you never went over the
line. No, I didn't want to didn't want to provoke an international incident. So.
Right.
Stayed out of Cambodia.
that's good thinking. I don't think there's any doubt about that. All right. Now you mentioned that you were only here until about the end of March of 1966.
Yeah, I think about March 31st is when I left. Only reason they got me then was they'd been talking to me, trying to get me to volunteer to go fly the mission up the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and I did, turned them down. And
who had been trying to get you to do this?
The 23rd Task Headquarters.
Okay.
They would call me on the landline and talk to me, and I politely turned them down. And what the other fact, right there at the... When I got caught, had dysentery. I would call it really. He was so bad off that he just could not stop having diarrhea. So I told him, I said, "You get in the back seat, and I'm taking you to Tonsonute so you can get to an Air Force doctor."
Mm-hmm.
And for a couple of days he didn't want to do it. And finally he said, "Okay." So we climbed in the airplane. Well, I flew up and we landed in Tonsonute. I dropped him off on the ramp in front of the operations and got permission, turned right around, taxied out, and took off and left him up there on his own to go find a hospital and get rid of that dysentery, because he'd lost a lot of weight and everything. He couldn't even fly. He was so runny. So I flew the airplane back, and on the way back, I said, might as well stop and pick up the mail. And I can't remember the name of the little army airfield where our mail came from, but I landed on this PSP strip and couldn't stop the airplane. It just kept right on rolling. And going to run out of runway, so I ran it off out into the grass and got out, shut it down, got out, looked, and my brake line was severed, so I didn't have any hydraulic pressure.
How did it get severed? Do you have any idea?
No clue. Either it got hit by a magic BB or it got worn out or something, but it was severed. And what, unless I'd hit something, because it was probably about a third of the way up the strut, so I don't know what how that happened, but it happened. And I got out, got over to the ops and called the 22nd Task Headquarters there and said, "Hey, you need to send me a mechanic and fix my brake line so I can take this airplane on down to Rockjaw." And he said, "Yeah, Brimkamp, we got another airplane for you already." And I said, "Yeah, and I bet you got a set of orders with that airplane." And they weren't kidding. They came over and picked me up. It was about 4 or 5 miles away, I guess. They came over and picked me up in a Jeep, took me back to Canto, to the Air Force compound there, wined and dined me, put me up for the night. And the next morning, they had a set of orders and an O-1F. For me to go back down to Rockjaw, pick up my gear, and head for Benoit for a briefing. And so that's what I did. and got back down there, and they told the province chief what the problem was, and he didn't like the idea of being down, having no FAC at all there anymore. They didn't even have he didn't even have an airplane.
Right.
So I don't know how that got taken care of, but I went in there, picked up my gear, and they gave me a Viet Cong flag that they had captured and had set aside somewhere, I flew on up to Benoit that same day for my briefing, and there ended up, there were four of us at that time gathered together. One of them was Dick Strong, Bill Tilton, and Jim Cormanick, and the four of us gathered there for our briefing the next day, and April the 1st, I believe it was, we started our trek up the coast of South Vietnam, headed for NKP.
Now, were these other three guys, were they also with the 22nd at the time?
No, they were from different, I don't know what units they came from, but I was the only one for the 22nd.
Okay. Now, why did
they... We'd all been in country a little while, not very long, because I think... Cormanick may have left first. It's all dependent on how quick I don't know which one of us has been there in country long, but they pick people that have been in the country just a while anyway.
Mm-hmm. Now, why, other than this, what sort of things, why do you think they chose you in particular? Just because...
No clue. They're just looking for volunteers.
Hmm. And they chose the volunteers for you.
And they volunteered me.
And apparently things weren't all that
busy at
Rockjaw.
I wouldn't have been volunteered if my airplane had been intact and I'd gotten back down to Rockjaw. I think that's the way I see it.
Is that right?
I think because the airplane was out of commission, they knew they had me. They had their volunteer.
You had no choice in the matter.
I had no choice but being a volunteer.
Now, you said they put you up, it was at Benoit, I guess.
Yeah.
And they wanted you and dined you. Why would they go through this trouble? I mean, if they
volunteered. Well, the winding and dining was at the 22nd down there.
Oh,
the
okay.
The night I spent there with them to get my airplane out the next morning.
Okay, in Canto. Okay.
Yeah. They being nice to me, I guess.
Because they knew what they were going to do to you.
Well, I knew what was going on when I said, yeah, you got a set of orders. And they, yeah, we got you an 01F. I said, uh-oh.
Did you know what it was going to be at that time?
Oh, yeah, I knew what the assignment was.
Yeah.
As soon as they said that we got a set of orders, I said, they got a new airplane for you, and I said, you got a set of orders to go with it, don't you? And I knew what it was.
You knew that they were going to get you to NKP.
I knew. I didn't know I was going to NKP. I thought I might be going up with the Cubbies. But,
okay.
But, you know, staying in country. But mm-hmm. When I got to Benoit, I found out right away we're going to, the four of us were headed to NKP. I think they had something like... 12 pilots there already,
mm-hmm.
And about 12 pilots, about 14 airplanes, something like that.
Okay. Now, what were you going to be doing at NKP?
Well, I knew what we were going to be doing. We were going to be flying up the Ho Chi Minh Trail. I mean, we're going to be putting in strikes, directing airstrikes on traffic down the trail.
Mm-hmm. What did you think about this?
What? I don't know. I wasn't too concerned at the time. It was just another assignment.
Was this something that, I mean, I've heard some people say they preferred interdiction, these missions over the trail. I've heard other people say they preferred the working with ground troops, in support of ground troops.
Well, according to the Air Force at that time, I guess they didn't, I wasn't a fighter pilot, so they didn't put me on with the, with ground troops.
Mm-hmm.
Even though at that time it didn't make any difference. But later on you had to be fighter qualified to support, American troops.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because mainly our American troops weren't that involved. Our Hydrang Valley had just happened shortly before we got mm-hmm. there, and that was the biggest Marine operation, our biggest operation. So there weren't that many. It was just during the build-up, and they had plenty of facts to fly the support of American troops, and so we went where we were needed. And I guess the need was to fly, because they had started off, with a few on the Ho Chi Minh Trail and found out that it is doing some, doing good, because we are getting some strikes in. So that was I guess one of the reasons they wanted to beef up the, at that time it was just a detachment. It wasn't even a tactical air support squadron. It was just a detachment of troops, TDY. Actually, we were TDY.
Mm-hmm.
To NACOM phenomenon.
Yeah, this was
making all of $2.30 a day extra, something like that.
That's righteous bucks. This was Cricket, I believe, was the.
It was called Operation Cricket.
Right.
And we ended up flying. The area we flew in was called Steel Tiger.
Mm-hmm.
And our part was called Operation Cricket.
Now tell me.
They called us Cricket Facts with a call sign of Gombe, which mm-hmm. was not an Air Force approved call sign, but that was a call sign that was picked.
And it later changed to Nail, as I recall.
The Nails were changed. They changed the Nails on June the 1st of 66 when it became the 23rd TAS.
Right, right. When it officially became the 23rd
Tactical
Air Support.
Right, became the 23rd TAS.
Okay. Well, tell me about this area, Steel Tiger. For those who are listening and don't know where this area is, can you tell me more specifically?
Okay, if probably from Route 9, which is around close to where the DMZ cuts across South Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
you'd say east-west across Laos, up past into Nape Pass, which was north of Magia Pass. But mainly it was from Magia Pass on south down there, because once we got good air support and everything, Nape Pass became, obsolete according to them, because the trail out of Nape Pass to come south was too exposed. It was on a plain.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't jungle. It was just a wide open area. And I guess they decided they need to stay in the jungle canopy, you know. So
sure.
Nape Pass was, actually, I never saw truck traffic ever on Nape Pass from the whole time I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really Steel Tiger ran from there on down along the Laotian border with Vietnam, North Vietnam, and it came as far, and while I was there, it came as far as what we call Cricket West. Well, Cricket West was where one side was the Royal Laotian Army, on the other side was the Pathet Lao,
mm-hmm.
and that was probably about 6 or 7 miles inland, often, you know, depending on the roadways. That was what divided Laos into two different factions.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when we first got there, they told us we didn't have Air Force insignias on our airplane. We had these little slots where you put insignia or flags of Laos or Thailand,
mm-hmm.
and our flight suits weren't allowed to have any rank. Surrender all of our ID, leave it at home when we flew a mission. And I can remember flying a few missions in Bermuda shorts and combat boots, so I don't know whether they knew we were Americans anyway. So,
yeah, it seems as if it's a very poor effort to try to hide the identity of the American pilots and American
Right. You
planes.
Can't hardly hide a big old white American.
I would think that'd be the case.
And North Vietnamese knew Air America was there. They knew we were there. You know, once we started flying those missions, they knew those airplanes weren't flown by anybody else but Americans.
Right. I mean, it was really.
And the radio traffic, they knew the American voices. I mean,
you simply couldn't hide the American presence.
That's right.
Even if you were flying in Bermuda shorts, it was still pretty obvious who it was.
Right.
All right. Now, I've got a few questions for you here. The first one I want to ask has to do with the base there at NKP. When you arrived there, what did it look like? What was it like? Describe it for me.
When I got there, it was the end of the line. It was a pier steel plank runway. There was temporary. Our first quarters when I got there was a tent. And we lived in the tent probably for, I don't know, a short while another building was built, where we at least didn't have to double bunk, and we had a lot more open air circulating through the building. And by the time I left there, Red Horse had built more quarters, where only two guys had to live in a room, but there was no air conditioning for us until the only air conditioning came in June when the A-26s came in, and they were night flyers, so they had to sleep during the day, so they brought trailers in that were air conditioned. God, there goes my voice, air conditioned. Feel like I swallowed a cricket.
Speaking of crickets.
Speaking of crickets. Well, and the other strange part was when I got there, the first guy that I flew with was we'd gone through flight through upgrade or whatever you want to call it, training at Turbot together, and the guys in the unit, at least four or five of us were had gone with in training together there at Turbot,
mm-hmm.
which was a strange coincidence because you wouldn't think that many would get together in one location, but we did.
Yeah, that does sound very odd, especially the circumstances.
I guess they were volunteers. I sure wasn't.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Well, what about the other physical facilities there? You know, for mess, for showers, latrine.
I don't recall much about the mess hall. It was the food wasn't that great because most of it came out of cans, or because we were at the end of the line, we didn't get that, and didn't get much fresh type stuff until later on during the year.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't that palatable a type food.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, we got a swimming pool built eventually, and there was a theater, a small little BX. I don't know what it sold outside of cigarettes, and that was about it. The big deal was to try to get fresh fruit from Bangkok. If anybody was coming in, there was a courier come in once a day, and if you get somebody, one of the pilots on that, to bring fresh fruit, that was fresh fruit or fresh vegetables was a big deal.
I'm sure it was. So you were there at a very early time there at NKP, and you watched it grow quite a bit. Now, you say there were 12 of you who were there?
There were 12 there when we got there, so we made 16 and built up to, by the time I left, there were about 23, 24 guys there.
Okay. So certainly at the very early stages of what was going on there.
Right.
Like you said, it actually became the 23rd task while you were there.
Then once it became the 23rd task, they brought more airplanes and more pilots in.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now take me through a typical day. From the time you wake up in the morning, I assume you're flying mostly day missions. Is that correct?
We flew day missions up until right about December, I guess, of 66.
Mm-hmm.
The day before, we flew in pairs, of course, because of the hostile environment we were in. If one of you went down, at least you had a high man who could supposedly pinpoint where you were shot down, I guess is what it amounted to, but that was supposed to be our protection, having two pair of eyes and two separate airplanes, one flying cover for the other one. So we tried to keep a presence out there, you know, from dawn till dusk, and the missions overlap, but in order to cover the whole area, almost everybody just about got scheduled every day, because I looked at my flight log and I flew almost every day that the weather would allow flying, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And typically flew a 3-hour mission, sometimes a lot of times up to 4 hours, sometimes 4 hours plus, depending on what kind of mission it turned out to be.
Oh.
A lot of boarding time, a lot of just looking, watching, trying to catch traffic on the trail.
Where would you get your orders? The Tactical Operations Center?
We had our own little TAC center there, right.
Mm-hmm. And you'd show up in the morning and they would give you your order, or where you're going to go,
you know what the schedule was the night before, whether you had a 10 o'clock takeoff or 12 o'clock, whatever. Mm-hmm. And at first, our Steel Tiger was not broken up into different areas. We didn't have a specific block assignment. So you went out there and you just sort of freelanced the area.
Interesting. Now, right? did this change over time? Was
oh yeah, it evolved over time. Okay. It evolved to where it was chopped, where it's blocked off into areas, and you were you had a mission frag mm-hmm. order to go to a certain area and do that area.
Now, did this change occur while you were there?
Oh yes.
Okay, what were the differences in terms of effectiveness, do you think, between the earlier time when you say you're freelancing a little bit and when it became more structured, where you have the coordinates and areas?
I think it made a bit of difference. The area was small enough that you knew the whole area no matter what.
Okay. It wasn't that big a change.
Not that big a change as far as I was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was one of the five or six rebels in the outfit who didn't pay much attention to anything.
Now, why do you say that? Explain that to me.
Well, I guess you'd have to say we did our thing.
Mm-hmm.
We took a lot more risks than some of the others. We didn't fly high. We got down there and mixed it up. And that was the only way you could find the traffic. I mean, that was the only way you could find a bulldozer. That's the only way you could find trucks under the trees and things like that.
Okay. Well, that's a good point for you now to describe for me a typical mission over the trail. You know where the trail is. Like you say, you have to get low, especially during these day missions, because there's no lights whatsoever, and you're just trying to catch things moving as you see them
right.
through the canopy, through the jungle.
Right.
Describe for me a typical 3-hour mission over the trail.
Well, it's probably 40 minutes out to get out to the trail itself. And once you got there, you started flying back and forth. I always flew the airplane a little bit out of trim. It was in a skid most of the time, which is not real comfortable flying. But at least the airplane is not going in the direction it looks like it's going.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm going to interrupt you again here, Mr. Bremenkamp. Explain to the listener what you mean by the plane flying in a skid and why you would do that.
Well, you trim the airplane up so it flies one direction, but the nose points another direction. All you do is trim the controls, the rudder, so that the airplane is out of trim.
Mm-hmm.
You set the ball off center in the needle and ball. Not a comfortable way to fly, but if you flew straight, straight and level, that didn't look, you know, gave an illusion of the airplane going one way, but it actually was moving another. Not that far, but enough to be throwing anybody on the ground off.
Okay, this
but mainly
is for ground
flew,
fire.
You know, never flew straight and level for over 15 seconds at mm-hmm. the most. Always trying to turn, always turning.
Right. Or jinking is what I've heard a lot of people
jinking,
call it.
Jinking, they call it. Well, I didn't jink the airplane. I just gently made turns, you know.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you're moving in a turn, it's difficult to get hit.
Right.
The only times I got hit was when I was dumb and flew straight and level and too low and too slow.
Okay, now I want to get to this in just a moment. You're flying in the skid, as you say. You're looking for anything on the ground that's moving.
Anything moving or anything different, you know, mm-hmm. anything different. Most of us got to the point you could pick out the a new gun's positions because of the disturbed foliage. I mean, no matter how well they camouflaged, you could pick them out. And especially you see six little green dots that didn't look the same green as the surrounding area. You knew that there were six gun pits down there loaded with guns, the rule was stay away from them.
Mm-hmm.
Don't mess with them. But sometimes the temptation got too much, and all you had to do was ask, especially the Navy pilots, you'd ask them, do you want to tangle with a gun? Would you want to tangle with some guns? And, of course, most of them said, why not?
What kind of guns did you generally encounter? Were these
51s? First got there, encountered quite a few, several 37mm, mm-hmm. My closest encounter was I was flying right over the treetops one day and came into a clearing, and there was a 37mm hooked to the back end of a truck with a Vietnamese laying on the gun barrel taking a sun bath. And I wheeled the airplane around, and the gun was gone. I mean, whoever the truck driver was drove off into the deeper jungle as quick as he could. But he was sitting there out there in that clearing, I guess, waiting for the facts show up, and the facts showed up, but the fact was too low and too close to him.
Huh.
Or waiting on an airstrike. A lot of times the 37s never shot at the fact because the fact was not high enough for the capability of the 37s.
Sure.
But the 23s, the 23 millimeters, the 14.5s, and the 12.7s were pretty prevalent. And, of course, we saw quad-mounted 50 caliber or what you want, 14.5s. And, of course, headquarters said there weren't no such things down there, but they were. Like they claimed they weren't there, but they were there.
I'm sure you would know whether or not they were there.
They were there. We saw them.
Okay, now you're flying. You're looking for anything different, like you say. You're looking for guns that you can call in strikes on. Hopefully these Navy boys come in, the fast movers, and wipe them out. But you're also checking for traffic on the trail. If you saw something moving, if you saw a truck, if you saw a bulldozer, if you saw people walking or bicycles down the trail, what would you do?
Never saw bicycles, saw people walking. Usually, if I saw a moving truck or whatever, fire a rocket and try to get him to stop. And usually they wouldn't. But try to find out, you know, where he was going. If a truck was moving, you weren't going to get him anyway because you weren't going to get an airstrike in time to kill the truck. But you tried to find places where they were, you know, where they were hiding the trucks or where they were storing material.
Mm-hmm.
And that was mainly the best targets.
Okay. How would you tell where these truck parks or these little storage areas?
Just by the way the disturbance in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had to memorize the area. You had to know from one day to the next what the changes were down there on the ground.
Okay.
Or you could do... Like, I guess it was right after I first got there, I went out with one of my more adventurous buddies, and we split up, which we weren't supposed to do. And as I was flying through this valley, all of a sudden I see a flash of light. Well, I knew what it was. It was a light off of a windshield. And went over and investigated and found a convoy. And as luck would happen, got a flight of B-57 yellow-tailed Canberras and marked them and told them where they were and got a strafing run for both of them. And they set several of them on fire, and I had a nice little thing going. I had smoke columns rising in the sky, and they said, "Wait a minute, Fact, we've got bombs." I said, "Okay, bomb them." You know what they did? They put all the fires out.
Really?
The bombs. So they had no smoke signals anymore.
So it just robbed the bombing robbed the fires of the oxygen, I guess.
I guess, blew them out.
I'll be darned.
But I counted seven or eight trucks. I gave them credit for killing seven trucks. But that was only because they were sitting out. One of them, the one that I saw was out in the open, but it was covered with trees, camouflage. But for some reason, they didn't quite get the windshield completely covered. Now, if it hadn't been for that one little wink of light off that reflecting off that windshield, and I happened to be in the right place to get that reflection, well, they'd have sat there, and I'd have never seen them.
Hmm. And you said there were seven or eight trucks.
Seven or eight.
Convoy.
Well, I counted seven for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And those Canberras got them. That was right after I got there. That was my first convoy.
Is that right? Interesting.
Yes, it was.
Okay, now, say you've called in a successful strike on this convoy, either in this particular case or in general, what would you do next? You'd expended your markers, I assume, the white phosphorus.
Right.
Would you go back to NKP, or would you still go around, depending on the fuel you had, or what would you do
next?
Well,
it depended on fuel I had, stay out there, because you had smoke grenades,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you could carry, you got canisters, smoke canisters, they weren't grenades, they were canisters, I guess you'd call them. So you flew your fuel supply, you know, your 3 hours or whatever, 3.5 hours, because you could still, you know, plus you got your high man, he still got his rockets.
Right.
But I never carried a rocket back. I don't think anybody ever really carried a rocket back.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I know at one time we ran out of Willie Pete rockets and we had to use high explosives, and that caused a lot of more of us to get shot at more because gunners realized we didn't have marking rockets anymore. But then you, once you get shot at, you drop a smoke canister on them, it kind of quiets them down again.
So you just open the window and drop it?
Drop it, open window. Well, I flew with the windows open all the time.
Okay, just so hot, I would assume.
It was hot, plus you could hear more.
Mm-hmm. Okay, tell me about that. We always talk about the visual aspects of this, which are, of course, vital. But tell me about the things that you flew with the windows open so you could hear. What were you listening for? How would you listen? What sort of things would catch your attention in this way?
Well, look, something that goes pa-ta-ta-ta-ta.
Well, that would be the obvious one, wouldn't it?
That was obvious. It's when you hear that, you know it's time to keep to turn, change altitude and everything else.
Right. Would you be able to hear any sort of truck traffic on the trail?
No.
No.
Never, never heard that, but the only thing I ever heard was, you know, ground fire.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, of course, you get the ground fire. One, you would, like you say, you would take evasive maneuvers. You'd move.
Immediately stay away from that and look for that area and try to find the source of it. Mm-hmm. Of course, usually they're so well camouflaged that you didn't want to go looking too much for them. But you, like I said, you could locate them if you were high enough and the position was fairly new. And of course, if it got very old, they would move their guns.
Mm-hmm.
But the favorite deal that they had was to set 6 23 millimeters or 6 14.5s in the star, what we call the Star David, and they would set those up in different spots, and so they'd stay there until the foliage wouldn't camouflage them anymore, and then they'd pick back up, move somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys you didn't want to run into on the guns on the ground were what most of us called the level 9 gunners. You know, you go 5, 7, 9 level. The 9 level was guys that were pretty experienced. They could hit you.
Right. Now, you said that you were hit one time?
I was hit with 23 one time.
Well, tell me about that.
23 millimeter. Oh, that was dumb.
Well, tell me about the whole mission. Tell me where you were. Tell me what you were trying to do, and tell me the whole story.
The whole story. Well, I was fragged. The A-26 on their night mission had spotted a bulldozer between the Alpha choke point, which we haven't talked about, and the Bravo choke point. And they said they saw it there and didn't know where it went. Well, my frag mission was go find the bulldozer. Well, that was no real big problem. Got out there between the choke points and right on the trail, I could see the bulldozer tracks. So get right down there with it, follow the bulldozer tracks and right into a big clump of jungle trees. And the only problem was the ceiling was about 1,100 feet, and I'm down below this ceiling. So instead of leaving the area like a dummy, I turned back up the valley and just merrily moved along and not paying much attention. I see this Vietnamese standing on the side of the hill there, and he had his arm up in the air, and got closer to him, and when he dropped his arm, the world exploded. I was so close to the guns that I think I was sitting right on their barrels. And of course, it sounded like when they hit the airplane, it sounded like a hailstorm. And all I did was, I was already below 1,100 feet. I dived down to the road itself and got away from them. And turned around and, like a dummy, didn't go home, continued the mission, went on to a different area and located several trucks that had been stopped, got back and turned in my report, and the officer said, well, I said, I think I need a decoration. He says, yeah, we'll decorate you with an Article 15. He says, you don't fly, after you've been hosed and got holes in your airplane, he says, you don't fly, you come home. So after that, I said, if I get clobbered like that again, I guess I'd turn around and come home.
Now, what was it they hit you with?
It was 23 millimeter.
Okay, 23 millimeter. Okay. So they peppered you pretty good then, huh?
They did a pretty good job.
But not bad enough, obviously, to affect
the
plane.
No, it wasn't bad enough. It scared the heck out of me. But
right.
I could see the holes out there in the wing, and there was nothing in the wings, in the strut. I had one in the strut, too. But nothing looked serious enough to me to have to go home. So
what goes through your mind when you've been hit like this?
What went through my first thing that went was how to evade it. And I mean, it was so automatic. All I did was I threw everything, throttled the mixture and the prop, all three controls full forward, and dived the airplane toward the road.
Mm-hmm.
Tried to get it as low as I could get. And
why down instead of up?
That airplane won't climb.
Okay.
So I had enough altitude I could get down low, and they couldn't track me.
Mm-hmm. Then eventually worked your way back up, and
then I worked my way out of that valley and back out and up, right.
And you said you were able to find some more trucks before you...
I went on through the rest of the mission. Down the trail was several trucks. There was one of them, had an accident and blocked the trail when it went through a little cut, and there were about six or seven trucks sitting there waiting to be... But I had to leave them for some other fact to get after.
Mm-hmm. Because of the damage to the plane?
Well,
because
of my time out there on target.
Okay. So you come back in, and...
unhappy ops officer.
The ops officer says he'll decorate you with an Article 15.
Right.
When you came in from one of these missions over the trail, what would you typically do when you got back?
Fly the pattern, land the airplane, and go debrief, and either go take a shower. I usually go take a shower because you're sweating like a Turk.
Mm-hmm.
I only went from 217 pounds down to 165.
So you weighed 217 when you went.
I sure did. I was a big fat guy. I didn't realize it, but I had back aches and problems, other problems, and I didn't realize it, but I had kidney stones, and that caused a lot of my weight loss.
While you were there, you had kidney stones.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I didn't pass them until I started home. But wearing the flak vest and sweating was, you know, a lot of it, I guess.
So you would wear a flak vest while you were
flying? I wore a flak vest all the time. Mm-hmm. I sat on one and sat on a piece of armor, a piece of ceramic armor that I'd pulled off of a helicopter that crashed down in South Vietnam. I carried that with me. That was my personal underseat protection.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it would have done much good.
Make you feel better, I would guess.
Made me feel better, right.
Now, when you get back, you go through the debriefing. Take me through a typical debriefing.
All you did was say what you'd seen, put down on the maps the position of any new guns, you know, because they were constantly moving the gun positions.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that had transpired out there during the night, and that was about it.
Then you say you'd likely to go take a shower.
Well, I usually go. Got to go take a shower. You're sweaty and stinky, and of course the Thai ladies, hooch ladies, that washed your clothes. I think they washed them in the river water because once you sweat them up, they stunk so bad you had to get out of them.
Mm-hmm. What would you do after this? Would you go eat? Go to bed? See a movie? Well,
sit around, maybe head down to the pool, especially had the swimming pool, go down, lay around the pool, drink a couple beers, four or five.
Was the NKP, did they have the nail hole open?
No, that came years after.
Years
after
later.
We were there.
Okay.
That probably was about 68, 69.
All right.
That was when it became a younger group of pilots.
Mm-hmm.
See, we were looking at the age group of ages of the pilots that we were. Most of us were over 30 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Now you look at the guys that did the nail hole. These were guys right 22, 23 years old, just out of flight training. A lot of them out just out of the Air Force Academy. It was a different attitude of what the mission was, you know, and everything.
Sure,
they
yeah.
built the nail hole and did all that kind of
stuff. Huh. I was not aware of this kind of a
they did the party suits difference. And all that. We never even heard of a party suit.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'll be darned. I wasn't aware of this kind of generational difference here.
Oh, yeah, there was a generational difference from those early guys to probably 68 when the younger guys started showing in,
mm-hmm.
coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us were captains and plus, you
right.
know. And these were, you know, when the Naval whole group were, you know, lieutenants, first lieutenants. And there were more of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think at one time, by the time they built it full strength, they had over 100 pilots there at NKP, 100, you know, OV-10 guys, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So as the American buildup continued, of course, more and more of these forward air controllers are coming to NKP, flying these interdiction missions,
right,
et cetera,
yeah,
there. And, of course, they're bringing them in younger because they need more of them, and they're
becoming
more readily trained.
Right. They've run out of us old heads. They've run through us.
All right. So I've heard a number of other forward air controllers say that when their mission was over, that they spent a lot of time at the ops center listening to radio traffic to try to keep up on things. Now, this was mostly with those who were in support of ground troops, but was this ever something that you did?
Not to my knowledge, not to my recollection. If there was a shoot down or something and you heard about it, you'd go try to listen to it, but that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or SAR, a rescue or something like that.
Sure.
God, excuse me.
And from your perspective, it certainly changed every day, but it wasn't something that was so massively fluid and dramatically changing, and with lives on the line, with soldiers on the ground, that sort of thing.
It wasn't like that.
Right. It was certainly, it would change, no question about it, but it wouldn't change as dramatically.
And not dramatically. No, the only thing, we got there, and of course, the first, mostly the activity, by the time I got there, they closed off 90% of the activity coming out of the Nape Pass, which is north of Magia.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Magia Pass, of course, has the reputation of being one of the worst places.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen pictures of Magia Pass later on where it looked like nothing but bomb craters. Well, when I first got there, I flew up Magia Pass at low altitude and was unimpressed and came back and said, I just flew up this place and there were toppled towers, and they said, you dummy, you flew up Magia Pass. I said, what's the deal about that? That's the worst place you could go. And it did become a little bit more hazardous as in that first year in 66, but we still could fly it, you know, fly it without really getting shot at that much. But we bombed that area enough, and they started building another road out of on a further south called Route 912, and it was Bankarai Pass. And we watched as they built this road, and it kept coming and moving, and every day they'd move 200 or 300 more yard meters on down the rail until they connected with the Route 911. It just started in April, and by the end of June, July, somewhere in there, they had connected the two roads, and they had opened the new pass. So we had two passes to contend with then.
Now you said that you were watching this slow but steady construction. Were you ever able to bring in any sort of?
We could bomb the head of it. And we could probably just.
Okay.
And if we destroyed a bulldozer or other equipment, well, the next day they had replacements there.
Hmm. What does this tell you about the approach that the North Vietnamese took to what they were doing there on the trail?
Well, their attitude was, we were never going to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were willing to you know, suffer the losses, but that we weren't going to stop their bringing supplies down the trail. And of course, in that environment, jungle environment, where I don't know how much exposure, how much the trail got exposed later on. In lots of places, you could see the road. I got, you know, a lot of my slides show where you can see the trail, but at night, they drove down the road, you know, in the daytime, they came down and hid. If they moved in the daytime, it was when it wasn't very much movement at all. I mean, they put those trucks where they were in a safer location. Every now and then we'd find, you know, some of them parked, but they were tenacious people. And if you interdicted the road and blew a big crater in the road within an hour, they could have it repaired. They had enough people along there to repair it. And of course, in the rainy season, we practically closed it down in 66 anyway, and there was no traffic hardly at all. Most of it was, you know, they would truck it as far as they could, and then it was carried on back, and you never saw these things. All you could see is footpaths.
Right.
And what were you going to interdict unless you found something that was strange and you wanted to, if it was a storage area or something like that. But at least they knew what they were doing, and after I did my tour, I read a book by Matthew Ridgway, and his statement was, you're never going to interdict supplies in a jungle environment.
Mm-hmm.
You're never going to stop the interdiction's never going to stop the flow of supplies. You may get some of them, but you're not going to stop it. And that was, I mean, they improved things, you know. Eventually, they even had a pipeline for fuel. Well, while we were there, they had to transport their fuel in 55-gallon drums. Of course, they made nice little targets, and they'd make beautiful fires if you could find them. Get you a nice big black cloud of smoke.
Right.
But they actually built pipelines later on, and plus, our claim was we bombed the cars so much that they were able to pave the road with limestone rubble that we ground up for them with our bombing.
What does that do to you? As you know, you've got overwhelming firepower. You know you've got all the technological advances. You know what you're doing, and you can see the damage you're inflicting. But like you said, during the rainy season, where trucks can't go any further, and you've bombed these things and destroyed these roads and places, but yet you know they're still going through. What does this do to you mentally?
No problem, as far as I was concerned. It was just the idea of getting the successes that we got. If you just got one a week or one every now and then, it was well worth it.
Mm-hmm.
You figured, well, we've stopped that group. We stopped that bunch of supplies getting there.
Was there any frustration that set in that really?
The only frustration was not getting the air power.
Mm-hmm.
Because priority at that time was still Rolling Thunder,
sure.
Going bombing North Vietnam. A lot of times you'd get diverted flights, and you wouldn't even have a target for them. So we formed a tactics committee, and we did set up choke points. We set up a choke point called Alpha, and then a Bravo, Charlie, and a Delta by the time I left. And these were points where you best could put those kind of strikes, where you could block the trail temporarily and cause transportation problems.
Mm-hmm.
And they became places where if you didn't have any other targets, you put them in on what we called the choke points. And that was the other places where it had to cross rivers or pretty good sized streams.
Mm-hmm.
If you could get rid of their fords. They didn't build bridges after we bombed their bridges out. They put little fords, and they were just like an underwater bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you could knew they were there, you could see the rapids where the water was turned up for there. But we didn't have laser guided bombs at that time in 66.
Now, were these B-52 strikes you're talking about? Were they
the only B-52 strike we had was in an area just outside of the Ban Karai Pass,
mm-hmm.
in what was called Harley's Valley, where we lost a fat named Harley and his backseater guy. And Harley's Valley became an arc light target, and they B-52s dropped bombs on that target. It was nothing but an open area, and all the North Vietnamese transporters did was drive around the bomb craters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it plowed the ground up, and they just drove around the craters and kept right on coming.
Right.
I have a pretty good slide of that arc light area that they used. That was the only arc light that we got. Right after I got there, the B-52s supposedly were going to lay a bunch of time delay bombs up into Magia Pass.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't hit the pass. They missed it. But they were delayed bombs, and they went off for about a week.
Huh.
But they weren't in the Bahia Pass.
And you say they were delayed. It wasn't like they were...
Delayed fuses.
Okay, so it wasn't like they had to have some sort of a certain amount of traffic or a certain amount of weight on them. They were going on their own.
No, I had one of the choke points one time when I was flying kind of low. Fortunately, a 500-pounder went off underneath me. And there was
what
a
was
delay
like?
Fuse right in the middle of the day. Boom. No airplanes around or nothing. This time-delayed bomb went off. It wasn't a truck in the way. It was me.
Now, what did that do to you? Did it?
Nah, I didn't. Well, far enough away, it didn't bother me.
Okay.
Some of my slides, you ought to see how close I was to some of the bombs that were dropped.
How close, or how accurate, I should say, were these arc light strikes?
Well,
the
place where these are, where they put this arc light, they hit the trail. They drove, like I said, they had an open area where, and it was good aiming points, I guess. They were able to bomb the trail, but I mean, it didn't do any good because they drove right, like I said, they just drove right on through that area. Mm-hmm. It slowed the traffic down, I guess you'd put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't a point where, you know, where it would stop. At all.
Now, Mr. Brimmenkamp, some of the materials you sent to us here several years ago, you submitted, I think, a couple of different stories about the fact book, the fact history book,
yeah.
I believe it was. Now, you've got a number of different missions, a number of different actions that took place that seemed to me that they kind of stood out in your mind. Now, there are a number of them here, but what I'd like to do is ask you which of these activities that took place, what sort of things like this stand out in your mind? Are there any specific things any specific missions or any specific instances in which you would like to relate to me today?
Well, the one was that one I found, the first trucks I found, you know, that after I hadn't been there but probably a week, and found those trucks in a convoy with the light reflecting off the windshield.
Mm-hmm.
And then on, I guess one of the better ones was at first we did orientation by not flying the new guy in a separate airplane, but flying him with you in the front seat of your airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And, after being shot at pretty bad one time, I decided no more orientation of anybody. New guy flying in the front seat of that 01. I'm going to fly in the front seat, and he can fly in the back. And so after we talked it over back at the TAS, we decided that, no, our new guy would fly the high man by himself, and we'd be the low man because... he couldn't really get that much from flying in the back seat of the airplane anyway, so let him fly the high man and watch what went on.
Mm-hmm.
From the high position.
Okay.
But I had a guy as a morning flight, and I had a guy in the back seat, and came on between the choke points, and found a convoy of about at least 14 trucks in a row, sitting in the roadway, all covered with camouflage trees, just been cut down, and looked like bundles of greenery sitting down there on the trail. Not too good a way of camouflaging them.
Right.
So that was one of the great discoveries, and that was, got hosed a couple of times. But talking about strange thinking, you know, strange thinking. When I first heard the guns going chattering, well, I thought the guy in the back seat had his shoulder harness unfastened and was beating on the side of the airplane. It wasn't. Learned my lesson about listening to sounds and thinking the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
so what was it?
I don't know. It was at least a 14.5 because it was pretty good chatter.
Mm-hmm.
One other time, that mission. turned out we destroyed all those trucks.
You got all 14
and
of them.
One other time I found a truck that had rolled over and it was carrying 55-gallon drums of fuel, and I got two Navy A1s to come in and strafe it, and it set the truck, all the barrels on fire. I had this beautiful fire going, and I'm flying, circling the area, and I happened to look down, and right underneath me, I had six 23-millimeter gun positions tracking me. I mean, they were crew-served weapons, and here's these guys sitting there cranking these guns around. Oh, they were camouflaged pretty good, and they're cranking these guns around, and what the heck should I do? I just sort of ignored them and kept on turning and talked to the Navy guys and said, "Do you guys, would you like to attack some gun positions?" And then, of course, there were six gun positions on this little hilltop, and the guy says, "Yeah, we still got our 50 caliber ammo left."
So they come through and strafe them.
Where are they? I said, "They're on this hilltop over here." I said, "I don't want to mark them because then you won't have any surprise, because then they'll know that I know they're there, because they don't. I think they don't know. They're waiting on you guys to leave so they can hose me, I think." And I said, "They're on this hilltop," and I forgot to really tell them. There were two hilltops. One of them had the camouflage guns on. The other little hilltop had empty gun positions on. Lee, it says, "Oh, I got it." And he rolled in and he fired away at the empty gun position.
Oh, no.
And I said, "No, it's the other hill." And they didn't shoot at him for some reason. And the number two, they didn't shoot at him. I said, "It's the other hilltop." He says, "Okay." He rolled in and they were connected. It would look like there was a red stream from the ground to the airplanes. I said, my only thought was, I sentenced these two guys to be shot down out of the sky. I'm sentencing two guys here to get killed today.
Now they're.
I thought sure they were going to get shoot them down, but they didn't. And they pulled off. And number two says, "Where are they? I didn't see anything." Lead says, "Well, you followed me in, didn't you?" He says, "Yeah, but I still didn't see them." I said, "Well, number two, you were on them just like lead was," and they strafed probably about four runs at that, and they silenced every gun.
Really?
And
under that kind of heavy fire.
Under that kind of heavy fire, and I don't know whether they got hit or not. I never did find out from them whether they were hit. They thought it was great. I thought, gee whiz, you guys are crazy. When I saw what was happening, I said, I should never even told them where those guns were. I thought sure they'd get shot down. That's still a memorable sortie. Outside that, most of the sorties were not. I'd find an area I remember of finding caves or trucks sitting by the cave. I remember trucks sitting by a cave one time and had bombs dropped in there, and 20, 30 minutes later, the whole place would blow up. And I also remember having trucks sitting on the side of the road and having 4-105s strafe them and miss them all.
Huh.
That's frustrating, too.
Yeah.
And come out the next day, and that truck's gone. So it didn't even get one bullet to hit it.
Hmm.
But every now and then, find a truck or two or three, and if you were lucky enough, you got a diverted airstrike to destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
Had one mission in Cricket West where I had A-26 had just seen something, and anyway, it was a kind of a mountain inside this area. It was anywhere there were caves. And then they decided that we need the FAC come in here and show us where these cave openings are. So I got in there and I marked it for them. And they dropped bombs all over that bunch of karst, and things were pretty good. Anyway, they must have did pretty good, because the whole mountain smoked for about 3 days.
Wow.
So whatever they hit, they set it on fire.
Yeah, no intelligence on it, no idea
no
what
intelligence might have
been
on it, whatever, that outside the fact that they had seen movement, troop movement or ground movement or something, the A-26 had seen something in the area, and they wanted to strike, and we had the go ahead to go after that area. Mm-hmm. Which it was you know, not quite on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. It was called Cricket West. And the ambassador and the Laotians, well, the Laotians had approved that target area. See, west was where on the west side of the west was where the Royal Laotians were, and on the other side was the Pathet Lao.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we supported the Royal Laotians. It was interesting. It was an interesting tour, you know. A lot of flying time, a lot of sitting around, a lot of sunbathing by the pool.
You mentioned the Pathet Lao. Did you ever have to engage any of the Pathet Lao?
Don't know if I did or not. I saw them. I put airstrikes on them.
Well, tell me about one of these times you put airstrikes on them.
These guys were in boats on the river in their black pajamas, and they saw me, and they immediately paddled in the shore and hid in a clump of trees, and I got a flight of two 104s that bombed and strafed them. I don't know whether we got them or not, but they were definitely the bad guys, because as soon as they saw me, they ran for cover.
About how many of them were there?
Over 10.
Over 10 of them, and they were on the river then?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was the only Pathet Lao that outside of seeing, that was the only Pathet Lao I really saw. The rest of them, the rest of the troops I ever saw were North Vietnamese.
Hmm.
Like, on one occasion, I was almost dark and just out of a whim, I dropped a couple of smoke canisters out of the airplane along the trail, and all of a sudden there were little guys running everywhere. So I hollered at the airborne command post and said, get me some air. They said, sorry, fact, you know what time of the day it is. I said, yeah, but you can't give me an airstrike. They said, it's the wrong time of day. We don't have anything airborne. And there must have been 200 or 300 North Vietnamese moving down the trail towards South Vietnam. And they all got to move on. But that's the way it went sometimes, you know.
Well,
frustration, because you can't get any air, but there's nothing airborne. I mean, here you got, you know, North Vietnamese troops that you've actually got out in the open. There's no protection for them. They're there.
Now, you said that there was nothing airborne at the time. What time of day was this?
It was almost dark.
Almost dark. And they had nothing in the air
airborne
at the
time. To send to it.
That must have been incredibly frustrating that it wasn't coordinated
in a way. It's frustrating as a dickens, because you know they're going to go on. They're going to keep on going. They're going to go down and shoot at our guys. And I guess that was our main motivation. We discussed it. We knew that every truck we destroyed might save a 19-year-old's butt down south.
Right.
That was the whole big thing, was to, you know, interdict and get as much of that stuff off the trail as you could.
Huh. I've never heard anyone say that before, that they had nothing in the air that they could. Obviously, I've heard them say that they had nothing they could divert to that, to a particular area.
And nothing that could be diverted. It was frustrating.
Hmm.
Now, one other evening, I found about the same amount of troops moving down, and got one flight diverted of 104s, four of them, with four 500 pounders apiece, and we did put airstrikes in on them. But how effective was it? But by the time it was over, couldn't tell how many troops, you know, how much damage we'd done to the troops, because it was dark by the time got through bombing the troops out in there, right along the side of the trail.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as they saw us, they get into the jungle as quick as they can.
Sure.
Off the trail. But we don't know how many of those we really, really hurt. But that was the only airstrike we could get. But at least it was better than the first time that I encountered, you know, troops on the ground, that many of them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Moving down that road unscathed.
Were you involved in any night missions over the trail?
That was close as I came to night missions after I was flying late. No,
okay.
The night mission started in December, and I was right around December 1st, and I was due to rotate out on December the 14th, December the 20th or something like that. And the office officer says, Glenn, you're not flying a night mission because we want you to go home. And I said, wait a minute. I said, I've been here all this time. I want to fly. And he says, you're not going to fly a night mission. He says, I won't put you on one. So I didn't get to fly a night mission. But we initiated the night flying then with the Starlight scopes.
Mm-hmm.
And some of my, you know, a couple of my good buddies got to fly the mission. And they did good. They could spot the trucks, you know, but hitting them and getting a rendezvous with the air power and all that. I cannot recall whether how much effectiveness there was, because checking the next day, you never found, you know, the truck kills that they thought they might have gotten.
Mm-hmm.
But at least they slowed the traffic down. If nothing else, they may have stopped some of them that we found out on the road. You know, you find a truck isolator, or one of them that the truck driver got panicked and rolled it over or ran into a tree or something.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not start of the night missions. That was in December of 66. That was the start of the night flying.
Okay.
You put two up. You flew a single 01 out there, you know, with the guy in the front seat and the guy in the back seat had the Starlight scope.
Mm-hmm.
And tried to. And I can't remember whether they were carrying a flare or not. I'm not too sure. But they were trying to locate them and then get the A-26s to, you know, interdict them.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, all we had, you know, the A-26s, we didn't have the T-28s. T-28s came shortly after I left there. They flew some night missions.
Now, when you would return back, I mean, we've talked about some of the more routine things you would do after you debrief and go have some beers, take a shower. What about other things you would do in your off time? I'm thinking specifically here of letters home, of R&R leave, anything like that. What other sort of things were you doing?
We got to go to Bangkok once a month after we'd been there had there been an operation, I guess April, May, June, somewhere in there, decide that, hey, if you flew two missions the day before, you could get the day off to fly to Bangkok on the courier. You got to spend two nights, come back and fly one or two missions. Anyway, you had to get enough, you know, sorties in order to cover your time off.
Sure.
I don't recall too much about them. Go to Bangkok. That way you got good food, you had an air-conditioned room, you got to sleep all day and all night, whatever you wanted to do, and do a little shopping.
Did you do any sightseeing while you were in Bangkok?
Oh, I'd go on the river tour, do the river tour, and go around to the different, what do you call them? They weren't pagodas. I guess they are pagodas, and the different palaces and stuff that they had. In the, you know, Oriental things that they had, temples and things,
mm-hmm.
places like that. Take little tours.
Did you take pictures?
Pictures? I don't have too many pictures of off duty. The only ones I got that I found, I only found two slides of, was a Bob Hope show that we had there in December before I left. And Bob Hope's opening remarks, where he says, "Gosh," he says, "guys, this place is so secret, we had to land backwards today." And
now, was he an NKP? He came to NKP?
Yeah, he came in there with the entourage.
Well, tell me about that show. You have to see Bob Hope. Tell me about that.
It was a good show. Joey Heatherton, I remember, was one of the girls he had, young ladies or whatever. I don't know who else he had on the show. One of his sidekick guys that He got up there and on the stage and did about an hour-long show.
Mm-hmm.
Don't recall too much of it, though.
Did all of you facts get to go to the show?
Because no, the two guys that were flying, they didn't get the show.
Mm-hmm.
Probably about four guys missed it because of them had to be out there during the daytime flying.
Okay.
That was the entertainment we had. We had a theater. I think I sat through one whole complete movie, and lo and behold, it was one of the stars in it was Jane Fonda. I mean, it was the it was a Western comedy, and I can't remember the title of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, good gosh, I'll never watch that movie again after Jane had made her trip to Hanoi. We found out about that.
Now, what was your opinion of all that?
Of Jane Fonda?
Of her political stance and her actions, her activities. I know it's kind of a stereotype of
I like the posters. Jane call home, call Hanoi, 1-800-HANOI, and the others that say F Jane Fonda. There's no call for her and Tom Hayden doing what they did,
mm-hmm.
at all. And as far as any of the pilots that ever flew there, I know our attitude toward her. I mean, she really shouldn't be an American citizen anymore, and especially this top 100 women,
mm-hmm.
being honored and whatever. Her apology never was sincere enough to really be an apology, I don't think. And I'm sure I know all the facts have that opinion of her and how she was. When initially, 66, 67, there wasn't that much opposition to in the United States about the war in Vietnam. It's all of a sudden when the hippie crowd decided that, hey, we're going to be peaceniks and we don't have any business there. The business there was wasn't the war between the North and the South Vietnamese. The business there was as far as I could see, was between Russia and the United States. It was a proving ground for what we thought and what they thought they could accomplish in Southeast Asia and the rest of the world. And I think that they found out, both of us found out, that fighting a surrogate war just wasn't the way to do it, and neither country has had the deal that, hey, we're going to attack each other,
mm-hmm.
So it just turned into a big ball of wax. It just really didn't do anything except cause people a lot of hardship,
mm-hmm.
and kill a lot of North Vietnamese and a lot of South Vietnamese. A lot of innocents suffered on account of it.
Absolutely.
So I don't know if it proved anything at all. And of course, it carried over. But some of our police actions were justified and everything. But still have understand why does the United States want to be the policeman of the world,
mm-hmm.
especially when we don't get too much support from the rest of the world that we think we need to go help police, and I don't understand that. But
you had mentioned the anti-war movement. Now, of course, there's anti-war sentiment in the United States in 1965, 1966 when you're over there, but of course it doesn't reach its head until a few years later.
Right, later.
How aware were you while you were in Vietnam and then, of course, in NKP of the growing anti-war sentiment in the United States? How much were you learning about what was going on back home?
I don't think a thing. I don't think we knew a thing about what was going on,
mm-hmm.
At all. Because it just never got that far,
mm-hmm.
and nobody talked about what was going on in the States at all, really.
Yeah. What about in your letters home? I assume that you wrote letters home.
I wrote letters home, but you had to be careful because we were told we weren't to divulge where our mission was.
Sure.
Outside of giving broad hints to Mama that I wasn't where I originally was. And I think she read between the lines and was able to figure out from my descriptive prose that I wasn't in South Vietnam anymore. And I know she knew because some of the things that happened made the national news, even though we were flying on the Ho Chi Minh Trail in secret. Well, I remember one of the guys heard that one of his flight episodes had made the news back in the States, and we had what we called a gun sight on our 01. It was a metal rod sticking straight up,
mm-hmm.
and it actually a 23 millimeter hit that rod and bent it double. And he said it shook the whole airplane and vibrated so much. And anyway, somehow or another, the press somehow got a hold of that story, whether how it leaked out, we never did know. But he said his wife actually wrote him back and says, where did that happen, and who do you know that, who it was or whatever? So it was completely completely undercover that what we were doing, but nobody really knew what our mission was.
Mm-hmm.
Not it wasn't declassified until 91, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the story never got out of it, except for the tales that got told around the bar.
Now, you said you wrote letters home, but how often would you write home?
I wasn't one of these everyday letter writers. I probably wrote once or twice a week,
mm-hmm.
probably twice a week.
How often did your family write back?
Not that often, maybe the same amount. I don't know. I never kept the letters, and Mama never kept the letters I was sent home. So I really don't have a count of how. I do know I made one phone call home through the military MARS system.
Right.
And that's about it. All the contacts I had at home.
So did you get any leave? A 2 week leave? Many guys.
No, I never got a week leave. I went the only time off I got on a C-130 and flew to Okinawa and spent two nights in Okinawa, got on the same airplane and flew back to NKP.
What'd you do when you were in Okinawa?
Went to the officers club and ate good food and drank good beer, good wine. And that was it. I did go shopping at the BX and did the typical Southeast Asia tour guys what we were doing. I bought a tape recorder and a slide projector, and that was it.
I'll be darned. Typical tourist.
Must have had to have the tape recorder and the speakers. That's what it was. I'd set the tape recorder. You know, back in that days, the tapes were the big thing, you know.
Yes.
So I played tapes and had in the, where we're two of us were in the room, we had to set the tape recorder up and the speakers up and played music off the reel-to-reel tapes, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was after the base there at NKP had been built up. You had buildings.
It built up, yeah. Red Horse had come in and built us some better hooches than what we originally had. We were out of the communal living business.
right.
I mean, at one time it had about all the first 20 of us were all in a big old tent, and we had to double bunk, one above the other.
Mm-hmm.
That's how crowded that little space was. And then they moved us into a open bay area type building where we all had an individual bunk on the ground side by side. That was almost the first was like being in basic training. The second was I don't know what you would call it, but and of course our officers club consisted of a tiny little bar and about enough room for 10 or 12 people at a time in the place, a little old hooch.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember drinks were 10 cents a piece, something like that.
Wow.
I think they were 10, a dime a piece.
In speaking with other forward air controllers, one of the things that stands out to me is the personalities, the people. Facts tended to be very independent. Like you said, you had this kind of a rebellious streak in you and a few others. What was the relationship like between all of the forward air controllers? Can you try to explain that to me, the day-to-day relationship?
My relationship was, of course, I got to know, you know, the guy. I lost two guys out of my training class down at Hurlburt, and after the second one was shot down and not recovered, I learned not to get too close to anybody because you didn't know who was going to be next.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, protecting each other, and when we were flying as, you know, two-man teams and work together, and that was our whole big deal, concern, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We were fortunate in, like, you know, flying over the trail. Well, there was no real restriction on us outside of, you know, staying within the rules of engagement, 1,500 feet or 500 feet off the trail or whatever. And if you found something, you know, you more than likely are going to get air support, hopefully. And when I was in South Vietnam, you know, you were your own boss. I mean, it was your province, and you flew on your own schedule, and flew your own flight plan, and went where you. Sometimes you went where you were told to go because you had to deliver messages or stuff, you know, like that.
Mm-hmm.
Work with an operation, but the fact was an independent person. He was the only, he's the only guy who could tell fighter pilots where to go, you know, and what to do.
And they had to listen.
And they had to listen to you. So the fact was a good learning tool for, especially for younger officers, I'm sure, younger Air Force officers. I mean, it taught them independence and taught you how to think, because you were the on-scene commander. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it was your responsibility and your job.
Well, why don't we take a break there for today, Mr. Brimmingham?
Okay.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Glenn Brimmingham. Today is 25 August 2009. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Brimmingham is joining us by telephone from his home in Biloxi, Mississippi. Mr. Brimmingham, we had talked about how we'd covered most of your time in Vietnam pretty thoroughly, and eventually we need to start moving you out of Vietnam towards the United States. But you mentioned that you might want to relate some of the more foolish things that either you did or that you saw during your time there in Vietnam. Do you have anything in particular that stands out?
Well, used to play games with the truck drivers. We would, if you caught a truck and didn't have anything, any way of stopping him, you started using an M16 on him rather than use up your rockets. And a lot of times truck drivers would jump out of their vehicles and abandon them and leave them on the road and run for cover. One unusual event that I recall was right after the wet season, while they had road gang crews repairing the trail, getting it ready so the trucks could make it. I came on a group of seven people one day that were filling in ruts, I guess, and I guess mud holes, whatever you want, or maybe bomb craters.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the seven all went running for a truck that was destroyed, and I thought, well, they're running for shelter. But what they were running for was AK-47s.
Uh-oh.
So we had a running gun battle. They're seven AK-47s against my one M16.
I don't like those odds.
Well, they never hit me, but the reason I could keep them under, I had reached the point where I was down to one tracer every five rounds, so at least I could tell where I was semi-shooting, and kept them running up the trail, and they would run for cover, and then I'd flush them out with a few rounds, and finally I got an airstrike and tried to tell where they were, but wasn't too sure where they had hidden, but had two 105s drop bombs in the general area and did get a cut in the road again, so it gave them some more work to do.
even if they didn't hit.
Even didn't even find them at all. I'm not too sure we did any good there. And
how often would you do something like this? How often would you?
Too often. I used to get down low level, and they had built watchtowers along the trail. Mm-hmm. They had manned watchtowers, and in some of the open areas, and make sure there weren't any gun positions around. Get down and fire a few rounds at the guys in the watchtower. Of course, they were shooting right back at you. Nobody hit anybody that I know of,
mm-hmm.
but there was just foolish things like that. Get shot. They, you could hear them shooting at you, and you could see the guys. And just one of those gambit games, I guess, that we played.
I would guess they'd be shooting at you with small arms, AK-47,
small arms, right.
Things like that.
Their chances of getting you are about the same as your chances of hitting them, you know. And
so
well,
you'd fire your M16 out of the open window of the 01 while you were flying along.
Oh, yeah. I shot many, many, many rounds. And in fact, I wouldn't be able to tell you how many thousand rounds I did shoot, because I carried an ample supply with me.
Now, why did you decide to do this?
A whole box of clips with me, so whole ammunition can full of clips, so I didn't have any problem having ammunition for my M16.
Did other pilots do this as well, or was this just
not as many. I don't know if I might have been one of, you know, four or five that did something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not too sure that we all didn't do the same thing. Some didn't want to play combat anyway, and I mean, some of them, you know, were very cautious about what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think you did it?
Didn't know any better. I was invincible. Heck, I mean, it had to be invincible.
Would you, when you went back to the base at night, when you debriefed, would you mention this to any of your superiors about what you had done, or did they discourage it, or just this?
I didn't tell anybody about it. Don't get carried away.
Well, what other sort of things did you see in this thing?
I killed the truck one day when I couldn't get an airstrike. The truck had one of our choke points had rolled over and was laying on its side, and I had no damage to it. But one of the choke point areas. It's a pretty clear area, so I got right down on the level, probably only 15, 20 feet above the ground, and homed in on him, and I wanted to make sure I got close enough with the airplane to hit the truck. Well, I got so close that when the white phosphorus went off, I flew right through the white phosphorus smoke, so that meant I was pretty close.
Wow.
But I did hit the truck, so.
And you said it destroyed the truck right there.
Right there, but the scary part was, in fact, I couldn't pull up fast enough to avoid the smoke from the white phosphorus rocket, so.
It must have been a pretty wide area that was cleared, and pretty long area.
It was a good enough area, yeah, in the open where to get at it. I learned my lesson about getting down too close to the ground, because a lot of our strike areas where we had bombed so much, there were a lot of snags, big old jungle trees still sticking up there 150, 200 feet in the air,
mm-hmm.
that you couldn't see until you got right down there with them. And once you got down there with them, it kind of scared you a little bit, and you decided, well, this is not the right place to be. But those things like that, learned to stay away from Harley's Valley. That was not one of the places to go.
You mentioned Harley's Valley the last time we spoke. Tell me a little bit more about this. You mentioned that it was named after a fact.
Lee Harley and was one of my classmates in Hurlburt when we went through training, and when I got to NKP, well, there he were, along with a couple of the other guys that were at the NKP, or not, that went through Hurlburt with me. And Lee and he had a combat controller named Andrew Gillet with Gillet, I can't pronounce his French pronunciation, with him, and he was shot down just above a place that's named Ban Le Boy Crossing and Ban Karai Pass, which came out of North Vietnam on Route 912.
Mm-hmm.
And he was shot down over this valley area. Well, we named the valley Harley's Valley, where it turned out to be subsequently one of the most highly defended areas along the trail. It was also an arc light point too, because at one end of it, the B-52s dropped all their weapons on this one segment of the road, but all they did was crater it up and powder it up, and then you get out there the next morning and here'd be truck tracks weaving around the bomb craters. So we didn't do much about stopping them. Every now and then they might kill a truck, but it didn't interdict them that much. But that's how the valley got its name. And there were a few other losses while I was there. I might as well go down them.
Please.
Okay. One of the first fat killed out of NKP before we were the 23rd task was Carl Wurst. He was killed 3-2-66 in a midair with a 105. And he was a classmate of mine at Hurlburt. Next was Joe Brown. It was in a class at Hurlburt right behind me. He was shot down at McGee Pass, 4-19-66. After that was Lee Harley and his backseater, Andre Goulet. They were shot down 5-18-66. The next was a classmate of some friends of mine, William P. Smith, was shot down 7-23-66 at one of the choke points. I think it was Choke Point Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, the next one was right after I left. One of the guys that I checked out, because I'd become an IP during my tenure there, George Menges, was shot down January 2nd of 67. I left there December 24th of 66. Also, another classmate went through pilot training. His name was Charlie Claxton. He was flying the EB-66, was shot down 12-29 of 67 up over North Vietnam. A guy that flew with me from a 105 pilot named Carl Richter was killed on his 198th mission. He volunteered for a second 100 mission tour. He was killed the ejection, he landed on the karst and was subsequently died from injuries received on his landing. He was shot down 7-28-67. A guy that worked for me after I got back in the United States and was in my tech section, William Commodore Wood, was an F-4 pilot, was shot down October 4th, 1972. I think that just about runs down my list. I skipped Tom Wolf. Tom Wolf was a guy that came to us at the 23rd from A-1s. We were checking him out as a forward air controller so he could go back and fly support of the either Marines or the Army back in Vietnam, and he was killed in an 826. 826 came there in June of 66, and there were three of us that were picked to fly daytime orientation missions with them. And it was myself, Tom Wolf, and Dick Strong. And I think the third day out or something like that, the aircraft Tom Wolf was with, they decided they would take on a gun position up in Harley's Valley, and ended up the A-26 was shot down with all three crew members killed. That was 6-28-66. And in a real strange thing, in 7-27-69, Captain Ed Muskowski was a B-52 navigator, also was a godfather, my youngest son, was killed flying B-52s out of Guam. That just about runs down all the guys that I was close to, that I, was associated with, either flew with or was very close to.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I flew with every one of them except Charlie Claxton. The rest of them all probably flew in the same aircraft at one time or another.
Hmm. What does that do to you, Mr. Brimenkamp?
Well, I just sort of remember the anniversaries or the dates that they were shot down.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I don't know what I did. We did have one guy that couldn't handle the fact that his wingman was shot down and subsequently ended up back in the States grounded. But he just couldn't get over the fact that it was dangerous out there. It's dangerous out there.
What is it? What do you go through at the time when you lose these friends?
At the time, the big thing is you wonder, you know, did they survive? Did the Kansas any way of rescuing and that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
But outside that, it's just, hey, it's one of those things that happened. I guess some people handle it differently, but, it's, you know, so I was what they call casualty officer for one of the guys that was bunking right beside me. And, you know, you get all these special effects together and box them up and send them home.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just one of those. I guess it's just like some people can live with the combat losses. Other people, you know, it affects quite severely, I guess.
Do you
what I figured was don't get too close to anybody.
Right.
You know, don't get too friendly.
Well, even if you can keep this kind of distance between you and them, do you have time or did you pause to reflect on what happened to them and what could happen to you on your next mission or before your next mission?
I never worried about the next mission.
Hmm.
That was the one thing that never bothered me. The next mission was something to look forward to because I knew you were going to be able to do something no matter what. Or I did anyway. I knew I was, like I said, I knew I was invincible and the next mission was a chance to do something.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever called in to for SAR, for search and rescue on any of these? To aid?
No, I aided on the when Brown was shot down, but by the time I got to the scene of the thing, when another A1 was shot down, and the on-scene commander called the rescue off, and there was no rescue anyway because the airplane was crashed. That was Joe Brown, and he was recovered, I believe, in somewhere in the 90s, I believe, they finally was able to figure out where his remains were and where his aircraft was and got him out of that area.
Mm-hmm.
That was called? Joint
JPAC, I believe.
What it is.
Yes.
Full task force, something mm-hmm. like full accounting or whatever it was.
Yes, sir.
Out of Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And he was recovered. I think he's the only one of the facts that I know that I was there that, you know, has been repatriated back to the home. Rest of them, they can't. The North Vietnamese that buried them can't remember where they buried them, or they didn't ever know what they, you know, what they did with them.
Right.
And a couple of them, like, then bodies were never found because, like, the midair and stuff like that, and some of the scenes. I guess full accounting is just. I did a thing back in about 90 or 91. Worked real close with Joint Task Force and gave them all the sites that I knew, coordinates and all that, and they did a pretty good job of locating. They found one A1 pilot and one of those gunship AC-47
mm-hmm.
crews. They found them, and I think that's about the only ones that they got out of the areas that I identified. But that's as close as I got to a SAR. I didn't ever work a full blown SAR.
Mm-hmm.
Always got in on the tail. I got in on the tail end of one, and that was about. It was all over, and all I had to do. I was going to monitor the destruction of one of the helicopters that was unable to continue the mission. They had to abandon it, and we had to destroy it to keep anything, the guns and stuff, I guess, from just falling into their hands. But I don't think the helicopter was ever destroyed.
Right.
That's about as close as I came to a SAR. Hmm. Never got to one real one.
Right. You mentioned briefly that you were also an IP at one time there while you
I became an instructor pilot. Would give the guys a couple of rides and in the airplane in the local area to get a feel of landing on the PSP, and
mm-hmm.
then I would put them in the back seat and take them for one mission out, or what they call orientation, and then next flight they were in another airplane by themselves flying high cover. for somebody.
Right.
And that was it. But we found out you did need to pick guys out there. Like when we first got there, I mean, my orientation was, here's your airplane, follow me. And it took me a week to figure out, you know, where I was.
Right. Let alone all the things necessary to keep the thing,
right,
to pursue your mission.
Well, it took a while to learn what to look for out there, because it wasn't that easy to discern gun positions or where the trucks were or where the trail went. So it took a while.
What sort of things would you try to show the incoming facts?
I'll try and show them an abandoned gun's position, try to show them active gun positions. You always tell them what the gun position was new, because the camouflage used was a little bit, the bushes they used were disturbed, so they were a little bit different than what, you know, normally was.
Mm-hmm.
See, the gun positions we contended with were in Star of David configuration.
Right.
There'd be six gun pits in a circle, and they'd either have the 14.5, 20, or 23 millimeters in them. The neat ones were the 23 millimeters, where they had a gun crew, and they could crank those. They cranked those boogers down, but they couldn't. I watched them crank them around, man. They were good. They were good. Stay away from them. Let the fast movers go after them. Once
right.
you find where a gun was, stay away from it.
Right. Well, as you are working your way through your time here at NKP, you've flown all these missions over the trail. You're becoming very, very good, I would guess, at what you're doing. You're also serving as instructor pilot for the new facts, but you're also running down on your time in country. Did you pay much attention to that, how much time you had left as a short
time? No, I kept, you know, what I wanted to fly, and especially when it came time my last month there, we started the night missions, and we had a big fuss about me not getting to fly the night mission.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't get to, because they said, we only keep you here until you can go home. And they didn't even tell me what my last mission was, and when I got back, they told me that was it. So
do you remember your last mission?
Sort of. Didn't do much of anything. Just fly around in circles, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, out on the trail. But that's about all I remember about it.
Now, this would have been, what, December of
66? That was in 66? December. About
okay.
the middle of December.
Middle of December of 66.
Yeah, December 66. And then I was supposed to go to Bangkok and catch an airplane on the 24th of December out of Bangkok, heading back home, and I would get home the same day I left, you know, because of the time zone.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd get home on Christmas Eve. Well, turned out I didn't, because I went to the terminal and ended up in severe pain, and finally this master sergeant said, Major, I'm calling an ambulance. And they hauled me over to the Air Force side of the airport, where a doctor came along and says, well, I guess we're going to keep you here because we think you're passing a kidney stone. And they put me in the Army Field Hospital, and sure enough, I passed a kidney stone. So I got home the day after Christmas.
How long did
you spend an overnight
okay.
at the Army Field Hospital and passing the kidney stone?
So it was just overnight then?
Just an overnighter.
Well, I'd say just overnight.
It's kind of weak, because I had four more episodes, I guess, after I got back home from 66 on through about 1990. Kidney stones are not much fun.
Yeah, I said just an overnight, but just overnight with a kidney stone must have seemed like a month.
Until they give you that shot, it seems like forever.
How would you rate your care there, by the way?
The Army Hospital, great. I mean, great. By the time I got there, they'd given me a morphine shot out at the airport, and by the time I got there, these two corpsmen practically had to carry me out from the ambulance to a bed and get me in a bed. And they were great.
But you were good enough to go after that?
After that, the doctor said, go on, go back and book your flight and get out of here. So that's what I did.
And where did you fly out of again?
Out of Bangkok.
Out of Bangkok. geography. Now, did you fly up to, say, Okinawa? Did you fly to Japan on the way out?
I think we ended up going to the Philippines.
Okay.
And then refueling in the Philippines, and then Hawaii, and then to, this time, I think I landed in, I think it was in Los Angeles, if I remember right.
Is that right?
And I caught a commercial all the rest of the way home.
Okay. Well, one of the questions I always ask veterans upon their return home is, what was it like when you reached California? What was the atmosphere like? What was the mood like? How were you greeted?
Oh, nobody even knew I was there.
Is that right?
I got my flight and got home, and the only people that met me when I got home was Mama and three kids, and my daughter didn't even want to have nothing to do. Little old daughter was 8 years, I think she was 10 years old. She didn't want to have nothing to do with me for about a week.
Why is that?
I guess she didn't know who her daddy was anymore.
Of course,
like I said, I'd gone from about 217 pounds down to about 170, so
mm-hmm.
I was quite different.
Now, this was back in North Carolina?
That was in North Carolina, okay. Yeah, where my wife had stayed while I was on my tour.
What was that reunion like when they met you there in North Carolina?
That was
Carolina?
Just great. For the boys, it was all right, but for my daughter, she was a little shy about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was it, getting back. Because that was 67, the big old protesters still weren't out there doing their thing.
Right, right. It hadn't reached that degree at this point
yet.
Right. What did you hope to do once you got back? Obviously, you're going to stay in the Air Force. What did you hope to do?
Well, my big disappointment was 10 days before I was to rotate, I had my assignment changed from Randolph to Air Force Base in San Antonio to go to Keesler Air Force Base in Mississippi. Instead of being an instructor pilot in T-38, I was to be an instructor pilot in a T-28. Well, I thought the Air Force got rid of all their T-28s, and they were all over flying with the Laos and the Thais and the supporting the propeller war up in Laos, but found out that there was a military assistance program, and we were training pilots, third world pilots for the free world, especially South Vietnamese pilots, and ended up at Keesler Air Force Base, Biloxi, Mississippi, and that's been home ever since.
Now, you were training
40 plus some years.
So although you were reluctant to take that assignment, apparently it worked out for you.
It worked out pretty good. I never left because, well, one of the reasons is I stayed here. I'm only 6'2". My boys were 6'4 and 6'6", and both of them were scholarship-type basketball players. Well, they both got scholarships, but neither one of them wanted to play after their first year, so Papa had to come up with some financing so they could get through their remaining years. But I told him, I said, if you don't think it's fun and you don't want to play anymore, don't, you know.
Sure. Now, you mentioned that you were a T-28 instructor pilot there.
Right.
You were training then South Vietnamese?
Our majority of our pilots were South Vietnamese. We probably, in the time I was here, I know we put over 300 pilots through pilot training.
Well, tell me about that, if you would. Tell me about your role in this, and tell me about your observations.
Well, my first class that I had, I was in charge of transition pilot training. Well, that was taking experienced South Vietnamese pilots through mainly instrument flying.
Mm-hmm.
But we also taught them some formation, but mainly it was instrument approach to flying. And after that class, I ended up with UPT. Well, undergraduate classes. I mean, I think I did a couple. I've heard of a couple classes through, I'm sure. And I had one class of all South Vietnamese, except I had. I had Venezuelan. I know that one of my. And then I had a Guatemalan as one of my students, and I had a Vietnamese as one of my students. So I put three classes through.
Mm-hmm.
Three different classes, mainly South Vietnamese, except one class I had was nothing but Jordanians.
Hmm.
And these were a bunch of wild Islamic guys that were turned loose with nobody to monitor them. And they had a ball. They were all of them were good pilots except one, and the one that was not the best pilot, they sent him, he, after he graduated from pilot training here, they put him in helicopters. And we all figured, man, of all the pilots to put in a helicopter, was one of the wasn't the best pilot. But
how prepared would you say the South Vietnamese pilots were when they came to you, or Kiesler?
Well, when I first got there, they were pretty proficient in English. I got, 67, and most of them had been through maybe 1 or 2 years of college. By the time I retired in 72, the quality wasn't that good anymore, and their comprehension of English wasn't that good, and their ability to fly was still as good, because we didn't lose too many of them. I mean, they pretty well were screened with their ability to learn to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And they were good pilots. When they left us, they were good pilots.
What was their attitude throughout training? Did you see one?
They were eager to learn.
That right?
Oh, they really were. Great, great bunch of guys, young kids.
And it sounds like they really took to it then.
They did. They worked hard at it.
Were you able to keep in any contact with them once they finished training?
The only ones heard a couple of, some of them came back, and one of them that I was in charge of the check section for a couple, 3 years or so, and one of the guys that I gave a check ride to came back here, and he looked me up. I think he still lives here, in fact. But they all were afraid of me when it came time to get their final check ride.
Why is that?
They thought I was tough.
Is that right? How had they ever gotten that idea?
Well, I guess my bloodshot eyes and my demeanor, probably. I don't recall ever busting any of them or failing any of them on their final checks.
Mm-hmm.
I probably did.
You said you did this until, what, 72?
72, when
okay.
I retired, right.
And you retired from the Air Force in 1972.
Right.
How many years did you have in?
20.
You had your 20 years in, and it was time to get out.
Well, time to get out, because Uncle Sam said so. He said, this is back when they had a public law of called 2010. If you had 10 years, it had been enlisted at one time, and you had 10 years of commission when you reached 20 years as a reserve officer, you were mandatorily retired.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't you didn't volunteer to retire. You were out.
Would you have stayed in if you could have?
Looking back, I probably would have. But getting out was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I went to start teaching school, and then didn't like that, and then we went to work at civil service, and that was gave me a better retirement than I would have had to probably had I stayed in for another 5 or 6 years.
Hmm. Although you retire in 1972. You've been in the United States since your tour, since the beginning of 1967. How closely did you follow the war after you were in the United States?
Well, probably kept up, whatever the headlines were and things like that. A little disappointed in the fact that we pulled out didn't really fight the war the way it should have been fought. So. But there's nothing you can do when the war's being run, from Washington, D.C. rather than from on the scene. It makes a whole lot of difference.
Explain what you mean by that.
We had a president and a secretary of defense that thought they were they could do the strategy from Washington and didn't have to listen to what was happening 10,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
But
would you say that this is a result of just decisions in Washington, or would you say that the commanders, American military commanders, both in Washington and in Southeast Asia, had a hand in this?
I think it's all from Washington. The commanders in Southeast Asia knew what needed to be done. They just weren't allowed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we got there when we were flying out of Nakhon Phnom and flying into Laos. We knew what needed to be done there, because the trail needed to be cut.
Mm-hmm.
But we were going to be, good guys. We weren't going to have a presence in Laos at all, even though we were going to bomb it into oblivion and drop more bombs on it than we dropped in all of World War II on Germany, and still didn't stop the North Vietnamese from bringing supplies. you know, from the north to the south.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't stop, or you can't interdict in the jungle, or against an enemy who is bound determined that no matter what his cost, he's going to keep right on doing and supplying his troops and to reach his goal.
Mm-hmm.
And we may have eventually ran him out of manpower, but it would have been a long, drawn-out process.
Right.
So we pull out. And, well, I think a lot of it had to do with the South Vietnamese government not being more on the corrupt side, thinking of their own selves instead of the mission that they should have been thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, filters down to the on down to the morale of their troops and everything else.
Sure, sure.
But once we pulled the props out from under them, it was over for them. Especially once we withdrew our air power support, the South Vietnamese were doomed.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about the South falling in 1975?
Kind of disappointed was all. The fact, well, but knew it was inevitable. It's one of those things that was going to happen because we weren't, you know, didn't provide that much support.
Mm-hmm.
After we started pulling out. And I guess the peaceniks won it.
Well, that brings up the next question I was going to ask you, in a way, is what was your reaction at the time to the way American society dealt with the war and the way the American political system dealt with the war?
Well, I think our leaders listened too much to the protesters and wanted to keep wanted to get out. I think they really just wanted to get out. I don't really know why they thought that way, but evidently decided that it was time to end the conflict. It wasn't something we couldn't win, but it was, I guess, pressure.
How do you think that the U.S. could have won that?
How did they quit if they wanted?
Yes, sir.
We could have done the same thing we did to Germany and Japan.
Which was?
Bomb them until they quit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you've got all kinds of restrictions and you can't do this, you can't do that, well, you know, we found out in the Christmas bombing that the North Vietnamese were willing to listen. Now, had we started that type of bombing 3 years earlier and continued to do it, well, they would have never been able to take over South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But our attitude toward war changed from 1946 to 1970.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
And now we have reached that again. We've reached the point that we don't really want to engage the country that we're fighting against. Because we say, well, these people we're fighting don't represent the population. Well, they wouldn't be able to be there without the support of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read some diaries of our B-17 bombing raids, B-24 raids on Germany,
mm-hmm.
and firsthand accounts of what the targets really were. I mean, we weren't just bombing ball bearing factories and aircraft factories and places where they made tanks and stuff like that. And Dresden wasn't the only town that we unloaded on.
Absolutely not.
But nobody in World War II ever thought that was not the right thing to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This was how we were going to end the war. We were going to break the spirit of the country that we were fighting.
What do you think accounts for that change, Mr. Brimmingham?
I don't really know. I think one thing today, I think people tend to forget, because unless you're, I just calculating the other day, unless you're probably, if you're under 50, 51, 52 years old, you have no concept of what happened in World War II, Korea, or Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the majority of our population is, and that's where a lot of our attitudes are formed.
Right.
People who have no concept of what this country's gone through and could care less. I mean, since I've been substitute teaching ever since I retired from the civil service, and I read those history books that those kids in high school are reading, and when you get two sentences about the Vietnam War and they talk about Joan Baez, that doesn't tell them anything. And you
sure.
get one paragraph on World War II and they talk about us, you know, bombing Dresden or something like that. I don't think our school board people ever read these books before they authorize them.
Well,
I don't know. And while we know that, you know, our elite professors and are more on the liberal side, and they don't go with this stuff about what we really did and what really happened. So they glorify. You can't glorify war, because war, you know, war and combat just can't be glorified. But still, you need to tell the whole story instead of being covering. Well, maybe we shouldn't have done this. Apologetic, you know, a revision. I guess what a lot of people would call it is revisionist history.
Right. Sure. Just a completely different approach that has filtered through the system.
Yeah.
And like you say, now. Our textbooks are reflective of.
Oh yeah, they just don't even cut. They just gloss over and don't even cover what went. You know what happened.
Well, yeah, the story of textbooks in this country is a whole other issue entirely.
If they would spend just, you know, three pages going doing D-Day, just what happened, what transpired, what kind of sacrifices our army and our young guys made. Just so we could save another, you know, another country, not even fighting on U.S. soil, but in a faraway world, and what happened, and what kind of sacrifice they made. Same thing with the invasion of Japan when we went to Okinawa. Anybody under 50 probably doesn't even know what happened, transpired. Iwo Jima, Okinawa, they don't know. And, now we fight a warfare. It started in Vietnam. I remember supporting, you know, two guys with a rifle stop a company because, wait, so let's get the air power in here. We don't want to suffer any losses. And that's sort of become our attitude of we don't fight the kind of war that we fought in World War II or Korea
mm-hmm.
anymore. There are no front lines. We fight containment war. A policeman type war, and I don't know why we didn't learn from the Frenchmen at Dien Bien Phu, where you just don't put yourself in a fort and let the enemy pound on you for a while, forever.
And we're certainly very heavily dependent upon technology as well.
We are. Yeah, and I was just reading the other day where it looks like in 20 or 30 years, we won't even have any rated pilots anymore. We'll even fly our transports by remote control. There won't be a call for pilots. All the airplanes. How could you? I mean, you're going technology, and when technology breaks, you got a problem. That's like when our computers are down. We can't handle you today. Wait a minute.
All too often happens, of course.
All too often, you're right. That all too often happens.
Well, tell me, Mr. Brimmerkamp, as you look back on your experiences and the American experience in Southeast Asia. What can you say this country learned about itself? What are the lessons we should take away from this war?
Well, I think one thing we learned, I think the Russians learned, and we both learned that we sure as heck weren't going to have a World War III between Russia and the United States because both sides tested their weaponry during that time period. And I think what the American people learned during Vietnam was high losses weren't acceptable anymore. I mean, given American blood, for that kind of, for a different country, a different world, just wasn't worth it anymore. So I think that's why we fought these kind of wars that we have. But we still report, you know, how many Americans were killed this week, last week. We still keep a track. We don't pay as much attention to the numbers as we did in. Well, of course, that was McNamara's kind of war, to pay attention to the numbers and then, you know, if what's acceptable, a 13-1, 10-1, 5-1. At least we're not doing body counts anymore. Thank goodness. But we don't like to see, you know, Americans killed anymore.
Right, so sure.
We don't fight the kind of battle we used to fight. Probably never will. It seems like it's more, like you said, more and more dependent on technology and sort of a standoff type approach to warfare.
Mm-hmm. What do you think you learned about yourself the most? How has the war most affected your life as you look back?
I guess I grew up. I was pretty, you know, happy-go-lucky. Came back, I guess, took a more serious approach to life.
Mm-hmm. Why do you suppose that was?
The fact that, I guess, it's just growing up and knowing that you've done things that nobody else has ever done, and things have happened that just don't happen every day. You've seen a lot of different things than what you would see just normal day-to-day operation of the world.
Mm-hmm. What about you as a family man? How did it affect you as a father and as a husband?
No change there. I ended up with Little League. I'm doing coaching, officiating, managing. Gosh, I was president of these different organizations, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Just as if it was something just put by the fact that I'd been to Vietnam was just something I put behind.
Mm-hmm. Do you stay current with other forward air controllers? I know this is a pretty dynamic group. Are you involved with the forward air controllers reunions, the association?
I've gone to most reunions, yes. Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to you to go to those things?
Well, you go there because these are the guys that you share with you a common bond because you've been there and done that. And it's like some of them say, until you've seen the elephant, you don't know what the elephant looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And most forward, and I know every forward air controller has seen the elephant at one time or another.
Right, that's for sure.
So, you know, it's a common bond. I think it's even though you don't know the guy, you know him.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's very well said. Well, Mr. Bremenkamp, is there anything else you'd like to add to this interview?
Well, I got a quote that I have found quite a while back.
Okay.
It's by an anonymous U.S. Army helicopter pilot. And he said, combat dirt. Once you are exposed to it, it never wears off. It may fade over the years, but never wears off. And you will have to live with it. So that's about it.
Well, thank you very much.